son works there now. So.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Senator Wieger is here, so we'd like to get his bill done and get him out of here.
That's true. Yeah.
Senator Wieger, Senate File 3574.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 3574 raises the age for compulsory attendance in school from 16 to 18, or if you graduated at 17, that would be good. We have had a lot of discussion in policy regarding the importance of staying in school, the significant economic impact if you do not graduate. We had a lot of discussion, particularly from the St. Paul schools, Minneapolis public schools, about this, and also for the reason we're here on the impact on the habitual truant statute. I do have an amendment, an A3, which is technically not related to the committee jurisdiction, but it would put the bill in conformity with what we have put in our omnibus bill in meeting committee deadline. And it's, Madam Chair, it's non-controversial, and if the committee would allow that, would appreciate that. I do have Ms. Gilbert from St. Paul Public Schools and others, Mr. Tuma, Roger Aronson, and others that could talk about the need for the legislation if you would like that additional testimony.
Senator Wieger, by the Judiciary Committee putting on the A3 amendment, it's not going to provoke some of the policy members in your committee to ask for this bill to come back to you, will
no.
it?
All no. right. It puts it in conformity, Madam Chair, with what they had acted on.
All right. On the A3 amendment, any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now the Senate File 3574 as amended before us. Senator Wieger, all right, hang on a second. Ms. Gilbert?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I know that you have a long agenda this afternoon, so I will be very brief. Thank you for hearing this bill. We just want to make sure that we send a clear signal to the students in St. Paul and all over the state that having a high school diploma is a key to their economic future and to the economic future of the state. Minnesota households would have over $829 million more in accumulated wealth if all the heads of households had graduated from high school in Minnesota, and that it could generate an additional $1.3 billion to the Minnesota economy by 2020 if the students of color graduated at the same rate as white students. Currently, we have about 500 students that have withdrawn from school as 16 or 17-year-olds in Minnesota. We do have a pretty active truancy prevention and intervention program that we do with Ramsey County. Frankly, we have some limited resources there between the county and the school district. We would like to be able to do more. But again, this is consistent with our strategic plan and even the federal Leave No Child Behind, that kids need to be at proficiency and need to graduate on time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger are your witness. It seems to me that this is a wonderful idea, but working in the court systems, I see a lot of truancy, and I don't think they'll ever show up in school. They're not doing it now, and even though I know Ramsey County and Hennepin County and Anoka County and others do a lot of work in the truancy area, but it's how are we going to get these folks to school and have them learn something?
Madam
Ms.
Chair
Gilbert?
And Senator Foley, that's a very good question. You've probably heard the race that it takes a community to raise a child. And also one of the key things that we found out from all the education research is that if you have very high expectations for students and families, they do eventually raise the bar. And so if right now, if the cops would see somebody, you know, in the school park, and I live right by a high school, it'll be clear, just like if they're smoking and underage, that the law says that they should be in school and they can move them on back to the schoolhouse. It also is, you know, in some ways, it's just allowing us to state very, very clear expectations for kids that they are to be in school until they graduate from high school. It's just raising the bar on the expectations. And we use our area learning centers, we've had many different kinds of area learning centers to try and get students back into maybe a non-traditional school if for some reason the large high school setting is not appropriate for them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
When you look at that, as far as the truancy and those other elements, what solution do you have? It seems to me that you've got social problems, the single parent and maybe foster child and so on, that contribute greatly to that, especially in the core cities.
Ms. Gilbert, the habitual truant consequence here, in all practicalness, what is the consequence?
Well, we do use the court system to intervene with Ramsey County so that we do have a contract that we try and involve the parents and the student. And often it would possibly be an alternative placement, maybe an area learning center. Part of the problem is if kids get too far behind, they tend to drop out. They may drop out for economic reasons. Sometimes older kids are taking care of younger kids at home. I mean, there's a number of reasons. Teen pregnancy is another one. And so what we do with the truancy prevention program is actually look at all the factors that are contributing to the truancy and try and set up a program and a plan for them so that they can attain credit. Some of the area learning centers allow you to attain credit in a shorter amount of time, you know, rather than having to complete a whole year of coursework to get a geometry credit, for example. They break the pieces down into smaller groups so that a student may accelerate some of the learning in some of the areas where they're credit deficient. So it gives them a little bit of hope, too, if they get back in and get to work, you know, that it's possible. As you know, too, and of course it's changed a little bit with the Iraq War, but even joining the service now, the minimum requirement for enrolling in the service was a diploma. It used to be that you could just have a GED. And that's changed a little bit with the recruitment, but up until then, you know, I mean, so even to get into the service, that's the minimum requirement now.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just wondering, I have the same concerns as Senator Foley and a couple of questions, because certainly there are some schools in my district, too, where enrollment or where graduation is a very big concern of the rate of graduation. And I'm a strong proponent of education as far as someone's abilities and finances will allow them to go. But I wonder if involving at this age our criminal justice system, if that's really going to help the situation. Do we have a fiscal note with this? So we know, assuming that we're going to have an additional workload in terms of truancy, is that something that's being considered?
Ms. Gilbert?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, that's a very good question. Under the habitual truant statute right now, we can file a truancy petition as a habitual truant to a student has withdrawn from school without the district and the parents agreeing. And that could be for somebody who's 16 or 17 or even for the younger students who enroll in school. And that would be more of a child neglect petition. And many of these cases never actually get to the court. What it does is the county attorney, it helps us get serious with the students. So again, so we can get their attention and involve some of the other family members or the case of a foster parent to come up with some of the solutions that will get the student back in school. And I talked with Ramsey County Truancy Office, and they were actually concerned that they hadn't gotten as many petitions as the number of dropouts that we actually had recorded, because right now they're dealing with about 30% of them. But again, under current law, we can file those petitions in every one of those cases. That won't change that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more question that I had was, if a person does get a GED, let's just say they're able to graduate early or go through the process and get a GED, does that satisfy this requirement?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, that's another very good question. Yes, it does. Once they complete their GED, we no longer enroll them as a student and collect, you know, student information on them, so they would not even be included as in our student count as absent. And we do have a program that we do allow for the GED program within the system as well.
Any other questions for Senator Wiggers? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer us a suggestion that one of the things that I've noticed is that a lot of folks they're having learning difficulties also have problems in dealing with the large school versus a small, and when they're in some of these alternative learning situations, they do quite well if you can get by the disciplinary part of it. But that aspect of anywhere where in my high school there's something like 1,200 students in there, why people don't even know who the other students are.
Ms. Gilbert?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, you know, that's a good point. The other thing I want to point out, too, is that we have many students who come to us as high school kids that are coming from another country, and they are allowed to continue their education until through their 21st year. And so we have some programs for those older students to attend as well because they recognize the importance. So they're trying to master the standards that we require in math and science in addition to mastering English as a second language at the same time. And so we do offer a variety of those programs so that those students that need more than 4 years of high school, especially the new immigrants, have an opportunity to achieve their diploma via that route as well.
Any other questions for Senator Wiegar or Ms. Gilbert? Anybody in the audience here to testify either for or against this bill that we haven't heard from? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate file 3574 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and to your staff as well for their assistance.
Thank you, Senator Wiegar. Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. You know, I don't see Senator Ressa, Senator Cohen here, but I know that Ms. Timmons is here, and we have the revisor's bill. Maybe we can do that and get her out of here since neither of those guys are here. So hang on a second.
This is an amendment to it. 3674.
Madam Chair, members, you have before you Senate file 3674, which is the revisor's bill. This is historically has always been sort of a technical corrections bill. The revisors do a great job, and they go through and they find things that are missing or not being cross-referenced correctly, and so they put that together. They're so good that they have an amendment to their own bill. So I'd like to move the 0081414 amendment to Senate File 3674 to put it in the shape I would like it to be in.
We're just passing it out so that I can repeat what you just said.
I
don't know if you have it. Does
it come? It was in my packet. Here.
We had copies.
It's in the packet.
Is it the 08?
Okay. 14. Senator Moi has moved the 0081414 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Senator Chair, I'm going to have Ms. Timmons from the revisor's office go walk through the bill with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Senator Moi. For the record, I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes. And as Senator Moi said, this is our annual revisor's bill that corrects technical errors. We tend to find these errors during the interim period while we're editing. We also get errors called to our attention by Senate Counsel, House Research, state agencies, lawyers and the public. So we compile these errors into one bill annually. These are non-controversial items that do not change the substance of the law. This year, there are five articles in the bill. The first article is the longest and contains changes like fixing typographical errors, grammatical errors, and there are lots and lots of changes that are cross-references where an erroneous cross-reference has been made and is fixed. Article 2 deals with data practices, and some years ago now, the legislature passed a revisor instruction to ask us to start codifying some cross-references to data practices sections not codified in Chapter 13. And so after each substantive area in Chapter 13, there are groupings of additional data practices provisions that are codified elsewhere in the 25,000 pages of statutes that we have. So every year now in the revisor's bill, we are adding new cross-references to new data practices provisions codified elsewhere, and that's Article 2. Article 3 is a very simple one dealing with a name change from the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund to the Clean Water Revolving Fund. Article 4 deals with collateral sanctions from criminal convictions, and I believe it was Senator Foley who sponsored a revisor instruction a few years ago that asked us to create a new chapter, 609B, in the Minnesota statutes to try to collect cross-references to collateral sanctions codified all throughout those 25,000 pages of statutes. And so very similarly to the data practices Article 2, we now routinely collect new cross-references in the revisor's bill, and that's Article 4.
Madam Chair, members, starting at page 77 in the back of the whole packet of bills that you have is the summary, and I'm remiss in not having pointed that out so that you're not flipping through so many pages of bills. So at page 77 is the start of Article 3 of the Clean Water Revolving Fund. And then Ms. Timmons will go Article 4 on the collateral sanctions is at the summary is at page 79. Mm-hmm. And then Article 5 is where she's going to be going to. It starts at page 80, if that will help.
Thank you. And Article 5 is the final article, and this is to correct our revisor publications. We discovered that we had made an error in the publication of a 2007 session law. The Senate actually had added an amendment to this law at very close to the time of passage. We did not get the correct amendment. Fortunately, the House and Senate journals did have it right. And as you all know, we are a journal state. The journal controls. And so what we've done in Article 5 is conform that law to the correct version in the journal, and we wish to do that so it's correctly published with the 2008 session laws and properly recorded for historical research.
Madam Chair, members, that's the bill.
Do the members have any questions for Senator Moore? Is there anyone in the audience who has a concern about these technical changes?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'm curious to know where Betzel is.
He's always the revisor.
He's carried the revisor's bill for the last 12 years.
Long time.
Senator Foley, I guess I don't have an answer to that question, except that Senator Betzel is carrying quite a large number of our data practices bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, let's just say that when I was asked to chair this committee, Senator Betzel was very happy to unleash that responsibility on me. And we have a very, very good staff at the revisers. I've thoroughly looked through the bill, and it is all very technical. The one thing that I wanted to bring to the members' attention is with respect to Article 5, you know, that entire provision of the Health and Human Services Bill had to be reprinted in this bill. Mm-hmm. And I had some concerns that by reprinting it just for purposes of reporting in the journal, that we now have language in the bill that might somehow be misconstrued to be germane to other amendments. We think that that's not the case, that because this language is now law, we couldn't do anything to corrupt or contaminate the language just because we have it in here. So, Madam Chair, if there are no further comments or questions, I'd like to move Senate File 3674, recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Senator Moi has recommended that Senate File 3674 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Could we not put this on the consent calendar?
Madam Chair, if Senator Foley would like it on the consent calendar, I would be willing to do that. I'm just concerned that some people might object, but I'd be willing to do that. And if people object, we'll put it on the general order. So I amend my motion to refer to the Senate floor as amended to go on the consent calendar.
All those in favor of Senator Moi's motion as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
It's filling up time, too.
And this is 2886.
Senator Rest is here with Senate File 2886.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair. I and a group of my colleagues from my caucus in both the House and the Senate met since August. Got it. Thank you. Have been meeting since August, reviewing a number of fiscal policies, that have a lot to do with process and giving the legislature information in a timely fashion and looking at the way in which our whole budget process works. And we came up with a number of bills that deal with government accountability and reform, and we adopted among ourselves five principles by which we would look at legislation that was coming in front of us and looking at the budget. First of all, that a principle that accountability begins with accurate information and honest assessment so that we get straight talk to one another and with the administration. We should use straightforward accounting and realistic budgeting, that we should we can to cut bureaucracy and reward innovation, that we should be required to deliver results, and that's a requirement for ourselves as a legislature when we look at budget initiatives as well as the administration, and that we should be, even though we tend to go from biennium to biennium, that we should take a look at what the long term is when we are setting our priorities and that we make them as clear as possible. And Senate File 2086 is one of the initiatives in that effort. Compared to other states, we have in Minnesota less time actually to receive the governor's budget. We've received less information about issues being addressed and the responses being considered by the executive branch as it develops the budget. And this bill is one attempt to rectify that. In the first section, one of the reasons why the bill is here is because of the data provisions. And it is, the proposal says that keeps the budget proposals as non-public data, except for requests from the legislature. And then, of course, at the time that the, after that, the information may be disclosed, and after the budget is presented, the data become public. But we're talking about the preliminary work that's being done by the administration, and I believe that is the which brought the bill to the Judiciary Committee. The rest of the bill deals with setting some new dates by which information is presented, and the filing of budget estimates and require detailed budget estimates that are in the governor's budget, that they include the requests that are made by the agencies so that we can know what the original requests were and make some judgments about them in the budget process as it goes along.
Senator West, can you speak a little bit to, again, maybe I wasn't paying attention to the rationale for why the request from the legislature is not protected non-public data?
Why it's non-public data now?
Right.
I don't know why it's non-public data now.
Why would we
the
want
legislature
to, make it so?
To get the information
to get the
as
information.
That information would not be available to the legislature.
I see.
Except for making this exception in the law. Now, it would not be available to us.
Right.
What we're doing is keeping it non-public except for requests from the legislature, and it would then go through the process eventually becoming public data when the budget is presented.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Rest? Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, you mentioned at the beginning a group. What is the group called, and who are the members of it?
As I said, it's a group of my colleagues from my caucus, and both in the Senate and the House, and we have been meeting on a regular basis in discussing how we could suggest to the legislature ways in which we could improve efficiency in government government reform and accountability. So we've been meeting informally two or three times a month since August to discuss those kinds of things and trying to come up with principles that we would hope would be embraced by all of us. But our group started as a group of our caucus members.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator
and
Parasol.
Senator Rest, I applaud the fact that you went to the House too, so you made it bicameral. However, you didn't make it
bipartisan. Not at that point.
And that is a concern to me.
Madam Chair and Senator,
I have a feeling that we aren't having a good representation of both of the parties, or the citizens of the state represented by both parties.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Parasol, I think you make a good point. What we wanted, however, was an informal group meeting of our caucus members and to see what we could come up with. I think that once we feel that these kinds of principles are ones that would be embraced, and we think that they are embraceable by us at large, seems to me that it will be quite appropriate to expand that conversation, and we welcome the support from our Republican colleagues.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Parasol,
I think probably you could probably get some support, but have you shared any of the information that was gathered with the leadership, at least, if not all of the other party people?
Senator Rest.
We have had public press conference in which we handed out the principles and the information about the bills that are in this package, and then I guess in a sense we are sharing it with our colleagues, our Republican colleagues, as we present the bills in the legislature. Certainly, with some of them, the administration is aware of them, and in particular, one that I have on dealing with the Office of Enterprise Technology, we are accepting their amendments to the bill. That's also part of this package.
So I'm assuming, sometimes, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, that you have shared much of it with the governor, so that at least the administration knows.
Well, as the bills,
as
we release the information publicly, and as the bills are being introduced and identified as part of the work that was done by the DFL group to that extent. You know, Senator, Madam Chair, and Senator Parasol, I think just as you know, sometimes we like to start out discussions of change in government. We like to start out among our friends. And we know that we have Republican friends, but sometimes we like to start out with within our own caucus. And the Republican caucus has done that as well with their bills that are offered in the Senate that have all Republican authors, and just as there are all DFL authors. And we don't take offense at that and hope that you don't either.
And Chair, I don't necessarily take offense at it, but I have noted that this year in some of my committees that no other members of the committee's bills are coming out under their name at all. They're all coming out under the chair's name at the end, if they come out. And some of them are, of course, obviously declined hearings, arbitrarily, I think.
Well, Senator Rest, to the degree that the work may have come out of a working group, the Judiciary Committee is the committee for the Senate. And
yes.
We take bills in that light, and it is good this year that we have Senator Parasol as a member of this committee, because she certainly has adds a degree of integrity and good thought behind the work that we've done. So I'm glad to have Senator Parasol as part of the committee. Any other discussions on Senate File 2886? Anybody from the audience? Yes, Mr. Neumeister, I was getting to say, anybody in the audience would like to testify on the bill? So.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Historically, this was Section 1 of the bill, Subdivision 1, Lines 1-6 through 116 were done about maybe 12, 13 years ago. I worked a lot on this section. This was a bill because of the Carlson administration, what was happening, citizens and a number of folks were asking for budget and legislative proposals before the session started so citizens could get an idea what was happening. The Carlson administration at that time did a temporary classification with the Department of Administration, then became before the legislature, and it was approved. My only question, that it has been working very well so far, that the balance of that, what by taking out supporting data do not include preliminary drafts mean? One of the things about this is that this classification deals with budget information and also legislative proposals. So I just want to make clear that if one asks for what were your drafts of something or whatever, that is available. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my purpose of just coming up real quick, you asked for the historical aspect of it. I shared that when the question was asked. And number two, just raising that question by striking that, what that means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussions in Senate File 2886? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Chair, that is that the only bill I have here?
Yes.
I think there's another.
Well, Senator
Rest? I thought there were two bills on the other.
You know what? I'm going to Senate File 2886 has to go to the Finance Committee.
Oh, right. Yes, it does.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
yes. So, and I don't know where I sent it to. I don't think I mentioned where I sent it to. So, Senator...
move to reconsider.
Senator Shy moves to reconsider the vote that was taken in Senate File 2886. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senator Shy...
moves that is it Senate File 2886
be recommended to pass
and
be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Did we amend it? No. I'm sorry. Be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee on Finance.
That's correct, Senator Rest. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
What about Senate File 3201?
Yes. Yes. Can you take that? It's here.
Could I do that now?
Yes. 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 So that's next. Senate File 3201.
Madam Chair, Senate File 3201 comes to you from the Transportation Committee, and it is an attempt to bring the CDL licensing into conformity with federal regulations and adopts a number of provisions of those federal regulations into our statute. So if we do act favorably on this, DPS will be in compliance with those federal regulations and satisfy the deficiencies that were found in our own statutes. There are some enforcement issues in the bill that you'll want to focus on. And in particular, drivers need to report withdrawals and convictions to their employers who can then prevent them from driving illegally, and it gives the State Patrol authority to enforce out-of-service regulations with the goal of keeping unsafe drivers off the roads. Ms. McCormick is here from DPS to answer any further questions or if you would like more detail about any given section.
Sure. Ms. McCormick, can you walk us through Section 6 that talks about the notification of conviction for violation?
Madam Chair, certainly for the record, my name is Pat McCormick, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And as Senator Rest said, in August of this year, we had an audit done by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. 2007, I'm sorry. Thank you. And in that audit, there were several findings that our laws were not in compliance with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Act of 1999, as well as various federal regulations. And so, in particular, this Section 6 requires anybody that's operating a commercial vehicle, if they're convicted of any kind of an offense, a serious traffic violation, anything other than a parking violation, they must notify their employer within 30 days of the date that that conviction took place. In addition to that, though, that they also must notify the department if that took place out of state, so that the department and the state of record is notified of that and that we can note that violation on their record. Also, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration Act, or Improvement Act, also requires employers to ensure that they know the status of their drivers before they let them use one of their vehicles and go out with that vehicle. And as a result, This section also talks about the fact that once a driver receives notification of any kind of a suspension, revocation, or disqualification, they need to notify their employer by the end of the next business day so that the employer is not held liable for anything that might happen with them driving without a valid license. So those would be the provisions that we're ensuring match the language that the federal law has.
Very good. Members, any questions for Senator Russ or Ms. McCormick? Anybody in the audience here to testify either for or against this bill, specifically the provisions that are in the Judiciary Committee? See none. Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 3201 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Finance.
Oh, finance? Goes to the floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's already been
addressed. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Senator Carlson? Oh, Senator Cohen, do you have someplace to go? Senator Carlson's been waiting for a while.
Sure.
Okay. Let me see. Actually, he's not here. Senator Cohen? Senator Carlson's stepped out, so let's take yours because you have to go. Senate File 3307.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, thank you. You probably have heard from Senator Rest relative to what we've been working on. Senator Rest has been, as she indicated, responsible for chairing an informal group of people where we're attempting to get a better handle on the budget process, try to provide information in a better way for the state legislature. Let me just indicate, Madam Chair, for just a second, that this is not something unique to this year or last year. I've had these kinds of fights with administrations going back to, I think, Governor Purvich. I wasn't a finance chairman then, but certainly this is something that this has been an ongoing tension between the executive branch and the legislature, irrespective of the particular governor. The other thing I should mention, Madam Chair, is that the attempt is simply to try to provide more information in the legislative budget process. I have found it a great source of frustration to not have access to some information or the ability in promulgation of a budget, whether it be previously as a division chair or now as the finance chair, without having access to some of the information that is presented within the administration. So that's just by way of introduction. Madam Chair, I think the particular, there's a A1 delete all amendment. I'm wondering if members might be willing.
I move that. Is it an author's amendment, this first?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd move the A1.
All right. Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, I believe the interest of this committee was on some of the data privacy related matters, and I believe, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Ms. Pontius, but I believe the particular interest was Section 6 in terms of agency budget requests. Are Ms. Pontius, do you want to maybe highlight?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Pontius?
I think it's Section 4 is the legislative and budget proposal data, and actually the changes that are made there are part of them are in the bill of Senator Rest that the committee just passed. But then there's some other changes here, too.
Well, Madam Chair, and that's why I wasn't quite sure, because I know some of them were in Senator Rest's bill. Certainly in terms of the classifications contained within Section 4, obviously this doesn't change the non-public data, except, as it indicates, except for request from the legislature.
Correct.
And, again, I think it's not unreasonable to ask that we have as much information as possible. And let me just offer, kind of looking around the table, Senator Paraso serves on the Finance Committee. Senator Foley now serves on the committee, has been a division chair for the last couple of years. And obviously, Madam Chair, you and Senator Scheid have been involved with the budget process. Just think of kind of the way we handle the budget. We have a highly competent fiscal staff. The fiscal analysts do a spectacular job in serving the divisions and the full finance committee. The same is true of the tax committee analysts. But we have literally a handful of people compared to the people in the Department of Finance, the EBOs, the people within the agencies, the budget officers within the agencies, and it's a little bit more than just simply one hand tied behind our back. We also have the constraints of limited time. You know, we have not that we can't do work during the interim, but obviously in terms of all of us being together, we're talking during the budget year, January through May. So this does make some of this or strikes some of this as being non-public data, but I think it does so in a way that will enhance our ability to work with any administration in the promulgation of a budget. And I think the language is fairly clear in terms of what we're looking for. You know, we're asking for some of the work done within the agencies and within the administration.
Well, Senator Cohen, Section 4 is what's in the jurisdiction of this committee. The intent of that section is parallels Senator Rest's bill
yes.
that we just passed. Any members of the committee have questions for Senator Cohen? Senator Parasol?
Madam Chair, I understand this is a commission, but it doesn't name the commission. We have a lot of commissions. And what is the name of this commission?
Well,
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, the statutory reference is to the section of the statute that creates the Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy.
Oh, we have that. We have that already, don't we? That's
Senator
not a
Parasol?
New one. I thought you were establishing a new one here, Madam Chair.
No.
No.
Okay. It's a reference to that existing one.
Thank you.
Anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this specific provision of the bill? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, as Senator Cohen would probably remember, this fight between the Carlson administration and the legislature about the public's access to these budget issues and what the Carlson administration did in return. My question still stands out that I've asked now with taking out supporting data, including agency request, and then saying the points, supporting data do not include preliminary drafts. Maybe the legislature may get a lot of this information. I'm just trying to make sure that what the current intent of what has been of law for 13 years, that when citizens ask for that information on their own to the agencies or whoever it might be in the executive branch, that somehow by taking away this language, they'll say, we can't give you those kinds of things anymore. Bottom line, Madam Chair, members of the committee, with changing this, I just want to make sure that we as citizens don't lose out what we've had for the last 13 years. Thank you.
Senator Scheid is not here. Senator Foley. Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 3307 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Carlson. Senate File 2007, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, this is a bill to change the percentage of the damage which an automobile might sustain before it has a mandated salvage title. Minnesota has been known in the past sometimes as a title laundering or title washing state. And some cars have been brought in here and repaired, and they've been able to stay under the radar and keep their clean titles. Well, in this particular case, a clean title to some degree means that a person is not divulging the damage that a car has sustained. So what I'm doing is changing from 70% of the value of the car damaged to 60%, which, for instance, on a $20,000 car, that actually means that anything below $12,000 damage does not need to get a salvage or a rebuilt title, And it also in the statute, it says that you have to disclose that dealer or the seller has to disclose that the car has had that kind of damage. And if you would know exactly where that is, that's on the application for title. There's a checkbox in there that says that this car has not sustained beyond an X amount of damage. And right now it says 70%, and what we would do is we would change that to 60%. And what this generally does is it keeps a lot of the flooded cars out from other parts of the country and damaged cars from other parts of the country. It doesn't mean that a car will be totaled any easier, although it might be, because truthfully the market value of an automobile is lessened when it has a lot of damage done to it. I've carried this bill to some degree specifically because I bought one of those cars, and it was a lot less damaged than 60%, but I still think that 60% is reasonable.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Carlson? I filed 2007. Anybody in the audience here to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2007 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor, I believe. Yes. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you.
The committee will recess for about 15 minutes. We just need to make sure that we get all the authors here. And you all know that, you know, today's the last day. And so many members are hopping all over to the different hearing rooms. So we're going to recess for 15 minutes until 2:30. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come back to order. We're going to take up Senator Anderson's bill, Senate File 3396. Senator Anderson, I understand that you have a couple of amendments. Is there one that you'd like to offer as the author's amendment?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Yeah, this is Senate File 3396. This is our second committee. And so
I see.
It's not an author's amendment, but it'd be great to get it on the bill early because it will help with, you know, it might help to reduce the amount of testimony as we move forward. So I would just explain to the committee the A6 amendment. Maybe I should explain the bill first and then explain the amendment.
Let's make sure that we get the amendment and then and then as you are going through the bill, why don't we have you reference in the bill where the amendment makes changes to it? That would be helpful. I'm looking for the A6 amendment. It's handwritten? The A6?
No, the A6 is done. We're working on a second amendment that was just handwritten. We'll have to do that later when it's ready. I have the A6.
Bill.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Anderson.
All right, Madam Chair. This bill is the Subprime Mortgage Deferment Act, and the purpose of this bill is to ensure that we help those people across our state who are facing foreclosure, who entered into mortgages based on some very risky and shaky lending practices in the past. We know that the foreclosure crisis is really sweeping across our state and our nation. It's affecting many, many communities, not just in the metropolitan area, but across our whole state. And we expect over 30,000 mortgages to be foreclosed this year in Minnesota if we do not act on this bill. And I know the legislature has been looking at a range of solutions to the mortgage foreclosure problem. This is a very important part of the solution. What this would do is target very specifically either subprime mortgages or negative amortization loans. negative amortization loans being those which in which you actually pay less than even the interest due, so that you your loan balance gets bigger every month rather than smaller. And those are illegal under Minnesota law as of 2007. The subprime mortgages, we target in the A6 amendment, what we have done is proposed limiting it to subprime loans that are not originated by a state or federally chartered bank, savings bank, or credit union. So in the bill as originally drafted requires anyone who is going to get the relief from this bill to have entered into a mortgage between 2001 and 2007. It would have to be a subprime or negative amortization loan. The homeowner would have to live in the home and to intend to and promise to reside in the home for the period of deferment, which is 1 year. And the homeowner would have to make payments, monthly payments, to take advantage of this deferment. The bill would say, if you meet those conditions, we will defer the foreclosure for a year's time. So the payments that would be required would be that you would, and we changed that in the last bill, it would be essentially you'd make the original payment required at the time of the loan origination, or 65% of the loan at the time of default. So it would be
whichever is less or more. How do you know?
No, it's
okay.
Less.
Yes, whichever is less, Madam Chair. And so the idea is you would make a lower payment for a year, and then we would defer the foreclosure for a period of 1 year. The purpose of the deferment is, number one, to allow, as I said, thousands of homeowners to hold on to their homes for up to a year while we wait for some long-term comprehensive solutions to come from Congress to this crisis that's facing our nation. And I'm sure all of you have seen in the newspapers the stories every day about the mortgage foreclosure crisis and the fact that Congress is looking at very dramatic solutions. In fact, Congress is looking at solutions that go far beyond what this bill would do. Congress is proposing requiring loans to be renegotiated for the amounts, the principal payments to be brought down or renegotiated, and considering having the loans refinanced with public dollars. So there's some very drastic proposals being looked at in Congress. This bill is much more targeted and would simply say we're going to defer your loan for a period of 1 year, and it requires shared responsibility between the lender and the borrower. The requirement of making payments assures that the homeowner is continuing to have some responsibility for payments, and the lender has to not foreclose for a period of a year. But what the lender gets is the opportunity to get continued payments made on a home which would otherwise go to foreclosure. So lenders, bankers have testified repeatedly they don't want to be in the real estate business. And this would help them to the extent that it would prevent most of these homes from just going to foreclosure and remaining vacant and losing value, which is what's happening in the current market. So, Madam Chair, as I mentioned, the A6 amendment is an effort to target and narrow the impact of the bill. We've gone through Senator Scheid's Commerce Committee with this bill, and after two hearings, we did come up with a number of amendments that fixed many of the technical issues that were brought to our attention by the lenders, and we fixed them in a way that was favorable to the lending community in terms of making sure there was adequate time for lenders to adapt to the law once it passes, adequate notice periods so that the lenders could notify the borrowers, and language that made it clear that if the loans were deferred, if the mortgages are deferred, that it doesn't affect the marketability of the title of that property. again, Madam Chair, the basic idea here is to give homeowners breathing room to not lose their home, but also to help us protect our communities and our neighborhoods, because we know that those thousands of vacant homes are causing problems in every city and town where they are sitting vacant. They're magnets for crime. They're attracting different kinds of vandalism, and they are driving down property values in those neighborhoods. So, Madam Chair, I could go through the, if you'd like, I can go through and tell you the procedures that would be used, or maybe we should get to that as we go through the discussion. But I just want to emphasize that I think with this amendment, we've been asked to really target the bill so that we are focusing on the worst lending practices in the past years. So that's why we've decided to exclude the banks and the credit unions, because they have told us repeatedly that they didn't make these kinds of loans. And so we think that the bill as drafted would save about 15,000 Minnesotans from foreclosure. With the amendment, that may be reduced somewhat, but we just don't know exactly. And it does help to target it so that we're really focusing on the troubling kinds of lending practices. Madam Chair, maybe I should stop there and ask my witnesses to speak to this.
I think, Senator Anderson, that provides a good context for us to consider the A6 amendment, which is very narrow. Do members have any questions to Senator Anderson on the A6 amendment? Senator Foley?
It isn't that I see anything that I want to ask Senator Anderson. I was hoping somebody would look at the language in the amendment there. It subprime loan does not meet a subprime loan. It doesn't seem like it's properly worded. Perhaps Senator Scheid might have.
Well,
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I suppose you could say does not include or does not refer to. Subprime loans have been being made for a long time, and I mean, there's a legitimate place for that, but we've seen abuse in recent years, and so that's what Senator Anderson's bill is trying to do. So I don't know if Senator Anderson would respond or...
Well,
Madam Chair, it isn't the response I'm seeking, I guess. It's a language or grammar problem more than anything else.
That's true. Well, Madam Chair, it's exempting a certain kind of subprime loan, unless you just want to say does not mean a loan.
Madam Chair.
I think you get the same effect.
Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, I liked your original suggestion, Senator Scheid, to say it does not include or does not refer to, because we just want to be clear we're excluding one part of this subprime loan universe. But we don't want to take out the word subprime loan, because we want the negative amortization loans to be still included, even if they came from these groups, from a bank or credit union, because those are illegal. And so, and I think they would probably testify they don't have any of those anyway, but I just want to make sure that we're not excluding that possibility. So in terms of subprime loans, we want to target those to the non-banking universe.
So on line 1.3, strike mean a subprime and insert include a loan.
No. A subprime.
I think actually, Madam Chair, I think what Senator Anderson is saying is she would like subprime to stay modifying loan there.
All right, so just strike mean A and insert include A.
Does not include.
Okay. So just strike the word mean and just insert the word include. Senator Scheid moves that amendment to the A6 amendment. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now the A6 amendment as amended. Any discussions on the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm going to support the amendment. I have some concerns still about the definition of subprime. I think it still brings in too many loans
because what we want is to target the loans where people didn't fully understand. I don't even want to go there. Where they were victims of predatory lenders. I want to get it down to those loans as much as possible. So I certainly support this. I think we still should do some work on the definition of subprime, but that we'll have that conversation.
All right. On the A6 amendment, Senator Shy moves that we adopt the A6 amendment. Any further discussion? So all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senate File 3396, as amended, we will take testimony. Senator Anderson, in the interest of time for the people here to testify for and against this bill, let me just say that as much as I appreciate you all wanting to participate in the conversation, this committee has had a number of foreclosure bills go through our committee. And I believe yesterday and last night, we took another foreclosure bill. So we understand the urgency of the foreclosure context, and that's why today, yet on the last day of the session, of the deadline, we wanted to give this bill an opportunity to be heard. That being said, we also have a number of other bills that are going to come up after this. So I would ask you to be judicious in giving us your testimony. Because the more time you give to us to discuss the mechanics of the bill as a committee, I think that it will be better for this bill. So for those of you who are going to testify either for the bill or against the bill, please give us the information you think we need. Try not to repeat information. And to the extent that you feel like you need to build a case for us on the urgency of the foreclosure and why we need to do this, I think we got that. We know that, and we got that message. So those are kind of my caveat. I'm asking for your help because I really like to get the work of the committee done too. So, Senator Anderson, I think that you have four witnesses here. I'm going to start with Professor Prentice Cox.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Prentice Cox, Associate Professor of Clinical Law, University of Minnesota Law School. I'm going to just address one issue and we'll take any questions you have regarding the bill as well. The one issue I'd like to address is my understanding that there will be testimony today and there's concern now at this stage that's being expressed about still about the effect of this bill on loan securitization and the secondary market. Now, I'd like to point out to the committee that this is an incredibly targeted bill. It only deals with subprime and negative amortization loans. And it only deals with loans made until August 1st, 2007, when last year's predatory lending law went into effect. And it only is effective for people who can make substantial payments on those loans and are owner-occupants who have resided in the house for at least 6 months before and during the deferment period. Having said that, negative amortization loans are illegal. So there's no way in Minnesota. So unless we're talking about a loan through a federally chartered bank, which would be that those kinds of, it can't dry up credit for those kinds of loans because those kinds of loans can't be made anymore. So we're really only talking about the subprime credit market. That subprime securitization loans aren't being made anymore, and it's not because of regulation. It's because of the excesses of the industry. The industry collapsed itself through its extraordinarily imprudent and abusive loan tactics over a very long period of time that have now essentially created a global financial crisis. But the reality for us today is that those loans aren't being made. So there's no way that this bill, which retrospectively deals with the consequences for people, for communities, and for the entire real estate market of the conduct that occurred during the last 10 years, can have any effect on that market because that market essentially doesn't exist anymore. Therefore, you're down to some vague notion that doing something to help people and help communities and help stabilize the market because of this extraordinarily bad lending practices over the last 6 to 10 years, that this one-year deferment to get us to more comprehensive and, frankly, more extreme federal measures that are being proposed will somehow undermine confidence in Minnesota's regulation of the industry. And that, to me, is an incredibly speculative and highly unlikely position.
Thank you, Professor. Senator Anderson, anyone else?
Madam Chair, we have two homeowners who'd like to speak briefly about their circumstance.
Please come on up, and while you're coming up, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Professor Cox, I'm glad that you just jumped right into that issue, because I did support this bill even before it was more limited, although I think the amendment makes it a better bill. But I did read a letter today, a very lengthy letter that dealt with the issue that you're talking about, the loan securitization. And the question I have is that I understand that that there aren't going to be more of these loans sold in the future, but to the extent that these loans are still out there, and I'm not a person who deals enough with this that I'll probably say it right, but they're out there as something that's being bought and sold in the market. They still exist because they haven't been paid back. So they haven't just gone away just because we're not writing new ones. And so I'm not sure if the point that you made really gets at the concern, which is that as to that block of loans that need to be repaid that are sitting out there, if we lower their values, that has an impact on the people who are holding those loans that could ripple out into the market and, affect everybody else. I think that was kind of the gist of that letter. And so I'm glad you tackled that issue right away, because that was my concern. But I'm not sure if your response to it really fully satisfies the fact that just because we're not writing new ones, that we don't still have this bundle of loans out there that would be affected and somehow have an impact on the market.
Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think you have to distinguish between the effects that really matter, which is the prospective availability of credit. And the prospective availability of credit is highly unlikely to be affected, because there will be some exceedingly marginal impact on the holders of these instruments from the past lending period for Minnesota loans. A borrower can lend in Minnesota confident that going forward, after the passage of our landmark legislation last year, that their circumstances for the loans that will be made going forward won't be any different than than we've ever had, that we're dealing with this retrospectively. Will there be, to directly address your question, will there be an impact on someone who holds some interest in what we call one of these tranches from one of these securitized instruments? In a marginal way, possibly. I think that there is a lot of reason not to have a substantial amount of sympathy for those folks. And they have so much bigger problems. Today's New York Times was about the fact that Bear Stearns is now probably one of the major investment banks, is no longer going to be an independent investment bank, very likely, because of its extraordinarily losses that occurred in this situation. The marginal impact that this would have on that kind of market, given the extraordinary losses that have already occurred, is really small. But then you have to make a leap from there to prospective lending, and there's no rational lender who would make that leap and say it's going to affect prospective lending in Minnesota, because we're just strictly a retrospective action. And the holders of these instruments, were surprisingly, to me anyway, they're still decoding after all this time who they are. But the holders of these instruments ultimately were sophisticated players, very sophisticated players, who bought interest in these stripped tranches of trusts that were transferred from special purpose vehicles way down the line. These are sophisticated players, and they should have known better. And if they suffer a very marginal loss as a result of trying to protect our borrowers and our communities for retrospective conduct, I don't think it's going to have a significant impact on our citizens going forward.
Senator Scheid, is your committee starting your meeting right now?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. And I was, Senator Betzel is also on that subcommittee. And
A subcommittee?
It's a subcommittee on employee relations. It has to do with state contracts, Madam Chair. So it's outside of our regular committee structure. So
do both of you need to be on there?
We're both on there. He's going to check in. He'll be back. And then I'm going to go check in, and I'll be back. So if you wanted to recess for, like, 3 minutes or something.
Let's do that. Senator Anderson, is that okay? I'm going to recess just so that these guys can run upstairs and check in. We'll be in recess until 3:03. Judiciary Committee has come back to order. Mr. Ripplinger. Is it Mr. Ripplinger?
Correct.
You got to stand. Get real close to this microphone.
Please, welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record, and then you may proceed with your testimony.
Okay, Madam Chair. My name is Joseph Ripplinger, and I live at South Minneapolis at 3713 36th Avenue, where we've been in there since 1975. And I got caught up on this predatory lending. I believe it started in 2004. And then they told me that my credit wasn't good enough, and my interest rate was, like, I don't know, close to 9%. And then they called me back in 2006 in December, and they said that my credit is a lot better, and then they got me in that loan, you know, that predatory lending loan, and I didn't know nothing about it. And they said that it's a better loan, but I found out later that it was one of the worst things that I did, because I didn't know about that subprime lending that they started passing out. So we got that subprime loan, and we were really surprised because we tried to call them and tried to fax them saying that we didn't want it the next day, but they didn't oblige to our message or nothing, and they wouldn't even call us back. So we were just trying to keep going as far as we can until we get it renegotiated with the bank and see if we can get that down to where it's supposed to be. Because right now I'm paying the minimum and actually I'm going backwards because it's supposed to be $1,400 a month, and I'm just paying $560 a month. And I know it's going backwards. I'm losing about $700-some a month because of it. And I'm trying to get them to renegotiate the loan so we can get it back to where it was in 2004. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to the Judiciary Committee to share your story. Is it Mr. L. Enigas?
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all the members of this chamber. My name is Al Enigas, and I live in Apple Valley, Minnesota. I've been a music teacher for over 45 years, and I have a master's degree in music from both USC and UCLA. The way I got into this subprime loan, it was through a predatory lender. His name's Jerry Dolphin, and he was a licensed mortgage broker in Burnsville. Now, he and his two children had been taking music lessons for me for about 5 years, from about 1999 to 2006. And I thought that we had established a loyalty and a trust between us. July of 2004, I contacted Jerry Dolphin, and I asked him to get me a 30-year fixed loan and to acquire the Dakota County First Time Buyers Program that would then provide me with a 30% of the down payment. At that time, my FICO score was about 585, and I found out later that I would have qualified for a prime loan through the Dakota County. Jerry Dolphin got quite agitated and very aggressive, then proceeded to intimidate me with the statement that my credit score was not good enough. Then he said that the only type of loan that I would possibly ever qualify for was the type of product that he had been working so hard to acquire for me. Mr. Dolphin's hard-selling pitch to me was that after 6 months of paying steady payments, I could refinance to a fixed mortgage and get a better interest rate. He also said that when the interest rates go down, then so would my interest rates and so would my monthly payments. So after 7 months after the closing was in September of 04, I did approach Mr. Jerry Dolphin and requested to refinance the loan for a 30-year fixed, and that was in April of 05. Mr. Jerry Dolphin did not inform me earlier before signing any documents that I would have to pay prepayment penalties of about $4,000 to $6,000 plus appraisal fees, inspection fees, and closing costs. The first loan was with New Century, and that was with $270,000, for the first 24 months at a teaser rate of 6.9, a payment of $1,645 per month, which at that time I felt rather comfortable with that. The second loan that he acquired for me was for the down payment of $60,000 with Aquin with a 30-year fixed and a payment of $440 per month at 9.9. On October of 06, interest rates jumped up for the first time from 6.9 to 9.9, and now my payment was $1,889. The following discovery was revealed on February of 07 when I called Acorn Organization in St. Paul, Minnesota. On the closing papers, Mr. Dolphin had changed my income without my consent or knowledge from $3,000 a month to $10,000 a month. I didn't know that until Acorn had discovered that. Also, Mr. Jerry Dolphin got what is called an annual yield premium spread, which is also a fancy word for a kickback from the lender to the borrower for talking me out of a lower interest rate into a higher interest rate. He also tied my interest rate into the LIBOR, which is, I didn't know what that was, which is, I later discovered, was the London Index Bank Rate. The loans that I have right now are also negative mortgages, which means I am paying more in interest than I am on principal, which even if I did have a 30-year loan, I would never, ever pay them off. Jerry Dolphin is still out there making loans. I'm not sure if he's making any predatory loans anymore, but I'm sure he did a lot of them because I was not the only one. Right now, my payments are close to $2,400 a month at 11.125 interest, and next month the interest is going to jump up to 13.9. With Senator Anderson's bill, I am seeking some relief to get some time so I could renegotiate my loan with my lender, so therefore we could have a win-win situation for at least 12 months where I can actually have some wiggle room and I could also start paying some other bills that I've been defaulting on. This particular loan has really affected my life, where I've had to change a lot of my lifestyles. You know, I'm no longer buying any clothes. I've had to change my eating habits, where I'm just eating once a day. And as far as travel, I'm really budgeting my travels. So with Senator Anderson's bill that I am hoping that that could give me a temporary relief so I can renegotiate my loan and get down to at least where it was originally. If I can do that with Anderson's bill, Senator Anderson's bill, that would really be a blessing not only to me, but also to all the other people here in Minnesota that are involved in these predatory loans. It would be a win-win for the lenders as well, because they would also be getting some money on a monthly basis, and eventually we could renegotiate to something that would be really decent.
Thank you, Mr. Yunus.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And then we have listed Mr. Gene Ranieri from the City of Minneapolis.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Government Relations Director for the City of Minneapolis. As you're aware, the city has last year had approximately 3,000 foreclosed properties in its city. Many of them were concentrated in the neighborhoods on the north side of the city. The city has adopted a policy to try and find ways to prevent mortgage foreclosure and predatory lending. Last year we worked on that. This year we do support the Senator Anderson's bill because it has a goal to try and keep qualified homeowners in their homes so that they can attempt to renegotiate their loan and keep in the stay in the community and avoid, I think, a very important thing that's occurring, a byproduct of this whole crisis, is that we have a lot of abandonment, vacancies, which has led to trespass, vandalism, and theft. So we do support this bill. We know there are some things needed to be working out, but we think it will help not only the folks in the city of Minneapolis, but this is a crisis statewide, so I think it will help folks throughout the entire state. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ranieri. And Ms. Nguyen?
Wayne Nguyen from the League of Minnesota Cities. I would just like to echo what Mr. Ranieri said. And to save time, the League of Minnesota Cities did submit a letter in support of Senator Anderson's bill. So if any other questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We do have the letter here in your files, members.
Yes.
To be made as part of the record. Senator Anderson, I believe that those are the only individuals who have asked to testify for the bill. We also have a pretty comprehensive list of individuals who like to testify against the bill or give us their perspective. And I would ask, again, that to the extent that you could help us a little bit, I would appreciate you being judicious about your comments. So let's have, I believe we have Mr. Witt, Mr. Cantor, and Mr. Dunleavy.
And Madam Chair, I just also wanted to make sure members knew that I had spoken with the Attorney General's office about this, and there should be a letter, I think, that indicates that Attorney General Swanson is in support of this bill.
It's here.
You've got three people coming up. I'll move.
You can just add another chair to there if you need to. Mr. Witt?
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Witt. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As you know, the Bankers Association has very keen interest in all the foreclosure bills that are coming through the legislature this year. We analyze all of them based on what is best for our banks as lenders, but also what is best for our communities. As you know, we have a huge interest in making sure we have livable neighborhoods and strong communities. We have participated in all the task forces and all the working groups that have been working on the foreclosure bills this year. And we have been in support of at least 11 of the bills that have gone through the committee process here this year. Those bills, we think, will address specific problems that were identified in the working group process. And we think the process that was used allowed all the parties to come together and work out a lot of the issues and resulted in very positive bills that will address some specific issues. One of the things that we've heard comments on today is something that we agree with also, and what our philosophy is that we need more credit in these areas, not less. Mr. Cox has testified that he does not believe that this bill will have any implications on credit prospectively. I think there are others here who are probably in a better position than I am to address that issue. One thing I didn't hear Mr. Cox say is that this bill will result in more credit to these neighborhoods that really need additional funding. He said it shouldn't have a negative impact, but I never heard him say that this would result in more lending to the areas that really need it. Unfortunately, we are in a position right now that we're unable to support this bill. We do believe that it goes too far with respect to the state really dictating contract terms of existing agreements that are out there. And I urge all of you on this committee to look closely at the long-term implications of this bill. I urge you to take a close look at the policy implications of the legislation and what it means to have this state legislature rewrite thousands and thousands of contracts. There are other situations where the state has taken a position with respect to contracts between in our area between lenders and borrowers. One of those areas is in farmer lender mediation. But if you're familiar with that particular legislation, it does not go nearly as far as this particular bill goes, as far as really infringing on the contract that is in place between the borrower and the lender. I know we heard some situations today, and we've heard lots of situations over the past couple of years of extremely abusive lending practices. And I think that we have gone a long way to eliminate a lot of those abuses with people like Senator Anderson and a lot of the groups that are in the room here today. We've done a lot to curb those abuses. And the banking community wants to do whatever we can to help solve the problems that are out there. One of the things that I'll note is that there's a consortium called Hope Now. It's a consortium of lenders and servicers that have helped over 1 million homeowners receive loan modifications and repayment plans. And I think this group is doing it correctly by looking at the individual facts and circumstances of specific transactions and rewriting changing loan terms based on the individual facts and situations involved, rather than having a one-size-fits-all rewrite of thousands and thousands of contracts by the legislature. Thank you very much again for taking a close look at this issue and for hearing our interpretation of this particular bill. Lastly, with respect to the amendment that was just added, dealing with loans that were originated by banks, savings banks, and credit unions, I haven't had a really good chance to take a look at what impact that amendment has on my members, to see whether that amendment might in some way change our position on this bill. I don't know if excluding loans that are originated by banks and credit unions is going to really have an impact to the extent that we would change our position on the bill. I think we are. I'd be happy to take a close look at that, but I think we still have some significant philosophical concerns with the bill. And for those more philosophical issues, I'll turn it over to Dave Cantor.
Mr. Witt, before we go to Mr. Cantor, how many members are in your association?
Minnesota Bankers Association has about 460 members. All of them are banks that have actual physical branches or home offices in the state of Minnesota. And that represents about 96% of the banks in the state of Minnesota.
And so if we're looking at a state or a federally chartered bank, saving bank, or credit union, would that represent a description of your members?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. All of our banks are either have a national charter, they're national banks, or our state banks, either Minnesota state banks or out-of-state banks that have branches here in Minnesota. There are some Wisconsin banks, for example, that have branched into Minnesota. We count them among our membership as well.
Thank you. Mr. Cantor?
Senator Schott? Chair, forgive me. I just wonder if Mr. Witt might be the person to talk about the mortgage-backed securities. Are you up on that securitization? Or I understand what happens when we tinker in the marketplace. I know that what we do will have some impact. But one of the things I'm reading in the letter is, if we the letter from from the American Securitization Forum, that if we pass the bill with the delay, by delaying foreclosures, and we would reduce cash flows and devalue mortgage-backed securities that are collateralized by loans to Minnesota residents. I understand that statement. What's happening today to those mortgage-backed securities?
Mr. Witt?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you on that one. That is not one of my specialty areas, unfortunately.
I have to think that, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I won't challenge. I mean, if you don't, no, you don't. But it strikes me that they're not doing real well right now. And so I don't think that this bill is going to devastate that marketplace to the extent you do. I mean, Madam Chair, I surprise myself that I'm supporting Senator Anderson's bill. She almost fell over. And some of my friends in the industry also would probably like to knock me over. But, you know, it's not something that I did lightly. And I don't know if Senator Anderson said this, but we've both said it. I mean, these are extraordinary times. And families are being devastated. We're increasing homelessness. Neighborhoods are getting ruined, and communities are really suffering, and the cities that I represent are struggling with this issue. And the community development director from the city I live in, Brooklyn Park, testified in favor of this bill, as well as the cities represented today. So we just have this combination of the debt of people and not being able to keep up with these loan payments, whether it's negative amortization or if they were caught in a predatory loan. But their values are dropping, so even if they could get themselves better, if you will, by selling their home, it's hard to sell a home right now. Plus, the values, I think, in some cases, are below what the mortgages are. And I think the articles in both papers yesterday, I think it was yesterday, yeah, made that pretty clear. So we are just in this really difficult time, and I think it's really difficult for those who purchased mortgage-backed securities. And I'm worried about the marketplace, but I'm worried about the marketplace with or without this bill. And it's in a whole lot of pain and hurt right now. And so that's why I'm still nervous about which loans we're targeting, but hearing Mr. Ripplinger's comments about his 6.9% on the first and the fact that there may be a better way to define who these folks are rather than just through numbers, but I'm still struggling with that. But, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that about the – and if anybody who's going to speak can speak about the securitization issue and my question about that – I'd appreciate it. But it may not be these gentlemen. I don't know.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, and Mr. Witt, is that? You've indicated you've got 450 banks in the state of Minnesota. How many of those 450 banks have some kind of mortgages that fit in within this category? It seemed to me yesterday that we heard testimony from you and others that you didn't do much in the way of mortgages in the state of Minnesota and that they were, in fact, sold out of state.
Senator Foley, I don't think Mr. Witt was here yesterday at the witness table, but another member from the banking community was here. But Mr. Witt, can you answer Senator Foley's question?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, virtually all of our members originate at least some mortgages, either directly or indirectly through partnerships that they have with other lenders. If a small bank, for example, does not make 30-year fixed-rate mortgages that it keeps on its own books because that's not part of their business, they would often partner with another lender that would meet the needs of those folks that are in their community. So a lot of our members do originate loans you know, I think it's certainly a true statement that mortgage brokers originated the vast majority of the loans, that we would consider to be subprime. But that's one of the reasons why I'm not really able to speak to the amendment, because again, I'm not sure if how many of my members might hold these loans, even though they didn't originate them, because they might have purchased them in the secondary market or purchased them as larger securitizations. That's the piece that I'm not sure of right now as I sit here today, and that's why I would like a little bit more time to research that.
And Mr. Witt, when once you've had a chance to research that, if you can share that information, this committee would be interested.
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cantor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Cantor. I'm an attorney representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. I'd like to make two points. The first, following up on Senator Scheid's earlier comments regarding the scope of loans that would be brought within the definition of subprime loan. I do have a chart that I'd like to pass around to the members of the committee, which shows the index that would be used under the definition of subprime brought out of Chapter 58. This is the Treasury Securities Index. And the two right columns, this is for the years that are in question, 2001 through 2007. The last two columns on the page are for the 20 and 30 year maturities, which we would use. And the reason we have to talk about the 20-year maturity is because the 30-year Treasury certificate was discontinued for about 3 or 4 years during the time period in question. So what Treasury did was they said, for the 30-year index during those years in question, use the 20-year index, and then we'll establish an adjustment factor. And that adjustment factor changed monthly. It was sometimes positive, sometimes negative, but probably not greater than 0.2% in either way, either direction. So you can take the 20-year column there for the to use for the index and just think of that. It might vary up to 0.2% in either direction. As you can see, and as you've heard from the people testifying, a lot of the predatory loans were in the adjustable rate mortgage category. And under the definition of subprime loan in the bill in Chapter 58, that would add 2% to the index. So if you look at the index in question, you're talking about loans with rates in the sixes and sevens that would be brought within the definition of subprime loan. And I don't think that borrowers who currently had a rate that was in the sixes and the sevens would be complaining too much given the market. So I agree with Senator Scheid's earlier comments that the definition of subprime loan really goes too far and there should be some narrowing of it. The second point I'd like to make is I'm very concerned about us going down this slippery slope of contract modification and what it means. The lenders, when they made these loans, based their interest rates and costs and charges for the loans on a certain assumptions, and one of those assumptions being is how long it would take to get the property back in the event of a default. Right now, what typically happens is when the borrower defaults, there's maybe 3 months of missed payments, be 3 or 4 months of missed payments before the lender starts foreclosure. Then there's the roughly 2 month notice period, and there's a 6 month redemption period. So they're expecting to get the property back in a year. During that year time, the lender receives basically no payments on the mortgage. They are, if the property is not does not have a value to recoup the losses, the lender incurs losses during that period. That is factored into what they're charging for the loan to begin with. Now, what happens with this deferment period, you are extending that time up to a year. Now, the argument, of course, is that they're getting some type of minimum payments during that 1 year period. But the truth of the matter is, given the minimum payment set forth in the bill at the rate originated or at 65% of the payment at the time, as you all know, during the early years of a mortgage, the monthly payment is barely enough to cover interest and makes very little dent in principal. So what's going to happen during this period is the payment the lender is receiving is not even going to cover the interest accruing on the loan. They're going to go further and further into the hole. Less capital will be available for other loans. And so it is a material change to the contract. And as I said before, I don't think the legislature should be moving in the direction of making material changes to contracts. This is a material change, and it affects what other people might do in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor. Any questions for Mr. Cantor from the members? Very good. Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy. Excuse me, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And there is not an official Bar Association view or position on this bill because with our processes it would take too long for that to happen. So I'm only here offering my opinion as a practitioner. I have put in about 200 pro bono hours in the foreclosure committees before the legislature, drafting a large percentage of the foreclosure bills that have been working their way through the House and the Senate, and also editing and testifying on those bills. My objective throughout this has been to maintain good title to real estate in Minnesota and marketability to title. I take no position on the public policy of whether the legislature should favor the debtors or the creditors in this situation. Before the hearing, I met with Prentice Cox, and I gave him some language that I don't think it's in this amendment yet, but I think it takes care of most of the technical real estate issues that I had that I was concerned about with marketability of the real estate. The remaining technical issue that I have is with the effective date and the transition provisions, or the lack of transition provisions in this legislation. All of the other foreclosure legislation that I've seen so far, most of it, a few things have immediate effective dates, but they're generally things that there's nothing in progress that can be interrupted by the change in the legislation. All the other legislation has an August 1 effective date, and the effective dates are keyed off of certain acts so that it doesn't happen during a transition. So, for example, something starts here, the legislation becomes effective. Does it affect the end of that act when the end of the act occurs after the effective date of the new legislation? So I'm very, very concerned about that. And this bill has it has no transition date like all the other foreclosure legislation that I've worked on. It has effective 7 days after enactment. And then if you look at lines, page 6, lines 2 through 8, the foreclosing lender within 3 days after the effective date has to give notice of right to deferment to each borrower. I think from a mechanical perspective, from the perspective of a practitioner, that's impossible. It's impossible that the foreclosing attorneys are going to find out about this legislation, that they're going to be able to identify which loans are subject to it, they're going to be able to identify what's subprime and what isn't, and they're going to be able to get these letters out the door within 3 days after the effective date. So I would ask for, excuse me, an August 1 effective date, and that it should state, like all the other foreclosure legislation, that it affects notices of sale that are first published after August 1, so that there's a clear record in the real estate record whether this bill applies to it or not.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel?
I'd like to move that right now. I mean, immediate effective dates make sense for state agencies. When you consider all the parties that are affected, they're going to have to know about this law. I work here, and sometimes I don't even know when my bills are signed into law. And it's hard to keep track of that stuff. So I don't think an immediate effective date is going to help, you know, all the lawyers, the bankers, everybody, you know, across the state that this would be affecting. So I move to strike Section 9 and insert the language that would apply to transactions on or after August 1 of, 08, and probably Ms. Pines, is that doable?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Senator Betzel, the bill is about mortgages that were initiated, 2002 to...
Okay.
2001 until 2007, August 2007.
But Madam Chair, how would an immediate effective date, how are people going to know?
Well, it would mean, I understand what Mr. Dunleavy is saying. His concern is that if it becomes effective next week, that they have, 3 days or... I think you changed that.
And Madam Chair?
Wait, Senator Olson. Senator Anderson. Senator Anderson, can you explain to us the rationale of this effective date that you have in the bill?
Madam Chair, we originally had it effective immediately, so we added 7 days. That's very short, admittedly, but the whole premise of this bill is that it's an emergency situation. If we wait until Mr. Dunleavy originally proposed, we should wait until January so the Bar Association could have their annual meeting to discuss it first. It's an emergency situation. If we wait, we're going to have thousands more Minnesotans losing their homes. This is an unusual piece of legislation. As Senator Scheid has said and I've said, it is rather extraordinary, but it's to address an extraordinary circumstance. I mean, we can talk about how quickly this notice can get out, that we can notify those who need to know across the state of this law. But I think dealing with this as an ordinary bill and waiting till August 1st would defeat the entire purpose of the bill. We're trying to defer these foreclosures until we have comprehensive federal action.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I tend to agree with Senator Anderson that we don't want to wait till next August, but on the other hand, it seems to me that it would be unfair if we have foreclosures that are in the process or almost completed. I mean, it would be unclear what impact this has on those foreclosures. So I think we do need to tie this to something like, you know, at what process in the foreclosure does it relate to, as Mr. Dunleavy said, would we exempt those where they've already had a first filing, or what would our intent be? And I do think it seems reasonable that people should have at least a month to become aware of this. So that would, to me, be something I would offer as a compromise suggestion, that it would be a month from some act that would happen within the foreclosure process that would make it clear exactly which loans would be included or not.
Madam Chair, if we're discussing the amendment, could Mr. Cox offer a comment on the amendment?
Mr. Cox? Professor Cox?
That's okay. Mr. Cox is fine. Madam Chair, I'd like to thank Mr. Dunleavy first for working out the technical issues on this. In terms of the effective date, in addition to what Senator Anderson said, this bill requires action by the homeowner in order to be effective. The primary actor here is actually the homeowner. They have to file an affidavit of deferment or nothing essentially happens. The only requirement for the lender that happens immediately is that the lender has to send out a statutorily prescribed notice. The foreclosing lender's attorney essentially has to send out a statutorily prescribed notice. The first one would go out only to people who have a foreclosure sale scheduled within 20 days of the effective date. Okay? So we're talking about a very small number of people. And then there's another notice that 21 days after would go out to anyone else who has a pending foreclosure sale. Other than that, as new foreclosures occur, you simply have to send the notices at the same time as another notice that was passed in 2004 that goes out for each individual homeowner. So for foreclosing attorneys, of which in the metro area in particular, there's just a few, we'll know about this immediately. I assume the Bar Association could send an email to all the real property attorneys through the state. They could send a letter. They would know about it immediately. And I'll go farther, which is, this is big. When it was announced, it was the headline in the Star and Tribune. If this is actually passed, According to the securitization industry, it's going to have national notice. So I'm pretty sure that a real estate attorney who does foreclosures would find out and send out the notice. In the off chance, having said all that, in the off chance the notice doesn't go out, unless that foreclosing attorney is considered in bad faith or reckless, extraordinarily high standards, there's nothing. There's no damages for the foreclosing lender, and but it does provide homeowners who find out about this with the right to do it. If you delay it 30 days, that's about 1,000 people who won't have access to the benefits of this bill, so that these few foreclosing attorneys would have more time to send a notice that won't actually lead to any damages or consequences on them if they fail to do it, as long as it's not in bad faith.
Professor Cox, while you were explaining the mechanisms of how those days are working, I see Mr. Dunleavy and Mr. Cantor shaking their heads, and I guess maybe really smart but reasonable people could differ in how they interpret the language. So to the extent that maybe you could give us some feedback on why you think the process is not as explained by Professor Cox, could you share your thoughts?
Madam Chair, I've foreclosed mortgages in my practice. I haven't done it in a significant way for probably 10 years. Mr. Cox said that there are half a dozen law firms that do the foreclosures in Minneapolis. That's not correct. Almost every law firm, almost every major law firm does foreclosures. There are lots of small law firms that do foreclosures that have a few clients. There are lots of attorneys in the outstate area that do foreclosures. So we're not just talking about a half a dozen foreclosure mills in the Twin Cities. But I can tell you that in those law firms, in the firms that do a high volume of foreclosures, the way this bill is drafted right now, their office is going to have to grind to a halt. Will they stop all their foreclosures, try to figure out which mortgages does this apply to, contact the lenders, try to figure out which ones are subprime or which ones aren't, because they don't have that on their computers. They don't have the interest rate. They get the numbers from the creditor. They don't keep that. Wait for the lender to get back, and then send this letter. There are lots of attorneys that aren't members of the Bar Association. I can't speak for the Bar Association. I can't say that the Bar Association is willing to take on the responsibility to notify the attorneys of this law that's got an immediate effective date that poses a huge malpractice risk and a litigation risk for lots of attorneys.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
This is certainly not intended to be a notice requirement that would impose any malpractice or litigation risks. And if we need to work on the language in that regard, I'd be very open to doing that. If there's a way we can, the idea is to, as Professor Cox said, the right to get a deferment is triggered by the property owner sending an affidavit to the lender after they get the notice of foreclosure. So then they know who to send it to. And that is really the most important operative section. In terms of the notice, if we can figure out a way to make it work better so that attorneys will be able to do it, great. And if we can make it clear that if they do their best in good faith or whatever it is that we need to say so that if there's an administrative problem, we don't want that to get in the way of the good things we're trying to do with this bill. So I'm hopeful that that could be work. We can figure something out. But I just am very concerned about the delay in this case, it would be an issue where it would just mean thousands of people couldn't get helped by the bill.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I wonder if it would be possible to work on language that would give the lenders the time they need, a reasonable amount of time, which I don't think needs to be till next August. But 7 days does seem really short to have to go and try to track down these interest rates, especially if they're handling a substantial amount of these cases, and first just finding out about it. And so that seems really difficult. But on the other hand, for people who want to take advantage of this, and can provide the information to prove themselves that they would fall within the protection offered by the bill, maybe what we could do is say that, that the lenders have until this much time to get the notice out, but in the meantime,
if a person, if a borrower can provide information to show that they would meet the qualifications, that they would have the right to take advantage of this.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's
Senator Anderson.
That's how it would already work. That if as long once you get a notice of the foreclosure sale as a borrower, you can trigger your right to ask for a deferment. So you don't need that notice under this law. This is just an effort to try to help with outreach. I mean, I don't want to just take it out of the bill completely, so I'm not quite sure what the best approach would be. But it's not necessary for the bill to work, for the rights of to deferment to take effect. And we're hoping that there will be a major outreach plan from the private sector, from voluntary efforts to really notify borrowers of this. And that's really going to be important to make this work anyway, but that's sort of outside the purview of this bill.
To move us along, Senator Betzel, can you withdraw your motion?
I'll withdraw it.
Senator Betzel withdraws his motion to strike Section 9 of the bill on effective date. And then what I would like is to the extent that we could address some of the bigger issues of a notice, maybe obligation on the lenders. I would like to see if Mr. Dunleavy and Professor Cox can go back to the room and see if you can figure something out for us to think about. And then I would like to have the rest of the testifiers come up. It's almost 4 o'clock, and I really like for us to be able to get to the mechanics of this bill. So that we can have an opportunity to think about and discuss the bill amongst ourselves. So if you can do that, great. If you can't, we'll come back and let us know, and we'll see what we can do with it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
As long as they're going to be going on working on something, could I suggest one other concern that I raised in Commerce that I'd really like to see some suggested language over that they might be able to address at the same time?
Senator Olson, you may.
One of the concerns that I had as we talked about this in Commerce was that the borrower was not going to understand that when they reached the end of the deferment period that they were going to have to be able to make that full payment. And I think that there might be so for example, if they had a lower interest, if they went back to that original variable interest rate that they had on a $3,000 loan and it went down to a $2,000 loan, at the end of 12 months, they're going to have to come up with $12,000 in order to avoid foreclosure if they haven't refinanced the loan. And I would suggest that the language needs to go at the end of line 4.35 when that notice goes out about explaining how this process works, something along the lines that at the time, you'll be required to pay any amounts deferred in one lump sum in order to avoid foreclosure, something like that. And maybe it should be even more prescriptive in terms of telling them each time they're getting these notices how much they're going to have to pay. I'm not sure what should be done, but I do think that's a concern so people aren't shocked or misled about what this will do for them.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
can I just say that that is, I apologize to Senator Olson because we did have, I remember this conversation, and this is the one thing we did forget to put in an amendment, and I agree with you, it's very important. We've made a long list of technical changes to the bill, trying to work out the technical objections, so that is a very important one.
All right. We have on the list here Mr. Hesse, Ms. Larson, Mr. Pierce, and Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, could I make one
Dunleavy?
Last comment?
Yes.
I echo Attorney Cantor's concerns about the constitutionality. I think that there's a good chance that this will end up in litigation over the contract clause, due process, and equal protection. And it's my own personal opinion that in order to pass constitutional muster, the deferment should be something like what was done in the Blaisdell case back in the 1930s, where it's post-sheriff sale. So we're not talking about modifying a contract. We're talking about modifying the debtor's rights under a state statute, the certificate of sale. It's state regulated. It's a state document, and it's a state law redemption period. And in the Blaisdell case, the court also, the legislature also had the judges look at how long should the deferment be, what should the terms of the deferment be. So there was an individual analysis by a court to determine whether it made sense to have a deferment on an individual basis. Thank you.
Thank you.
see Mr. Hesse. I see Ms. Larson. I see Mr. Martin. Is Mr. Pierce here? No. Very good. Mr. Martin.
I'll go.
Martin's not here.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson.
Members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We represent about 110 of Minnesota's largest employers. I will be brief, Madam Chair. You asked us not to repeat each other, and so I will not. I want to echo the concerns that were raised by the two previous testifiers regarding the issue of interference with the contract. Our concern with this bill it relates to the underlying premise of the bill, which is the legislature interfering with the contract. And frankly, the concern is the precedent that it sets. You know, the concern with the contracts that are outlined in the bill, we're concerned with, of course, but we're worried that it will send a message to the marketplace that the legislature is willing to interfere in contracts, and that is a message that we think is not a good thing for the marketplace. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stacey?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber does oppose Senate File 3396 for essentially the same reason as Ms. Larson outlined. We do think it establishes a bad precedent that the legislature will interfere in contracts. I think you have to think beyond mortgages that the subject of this bill and think of all the other contracts that consumers and businesses enter into. Because, you know, I guess I've been around here for enough time now that I know that good ideas and bad ideas seem to reoccur every once in a while. And if the legislature gets decides to rewrite contracts in one area, it certainly could do so in others in the future. And I recognize that Minnesota did pass some legislation back in 1933 addressing this situation, but the times were certainly much different then than they are now. If you just look at the economy then, GDP had declined for four straight years in 1933, and Minnesota now are expecting two quarters of a pretty minimal decline in gross state product. You know, the stock market had bottomed in 32, an 89% fall from its high in 29. While the market's not great at the moment and a little rocky, it is certainly not at those levels. And unemployment in the nation was at 25%. Nationally right now we're at a 4.8% unemployment rate. So while the housing market right now is not great, I don't think it rises to the level of the emergency that was declared back in 1933. And if we set a bar that is for an emergency that is too low, I do fear that the legislature will revisit this type of legislation in other areas, and that is our main concern. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Boy, Mr. Hesse, there are some people who feel like the emergency is pretty urgent right now, and I think that people always feel like quite urgent from their own perspective. But boy, the urgency is pretty tight right now.
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I'm interesting to see the discussion about. Actions that occurred in the 30s and 40s, it seems to me that there's some similarity in the banking industry today as it was in those days when the banks were closing and the people were left holding the bag. And I look at this and you talk about re-entering or re-examining a contract, but the fact is that is this a legal and binding contract to do what has been done to some of these folks, or can't we pass legislation that can correct that sort of thing? It just strikes me as that we're denying due process to people, and that we should be looking at that as much as we're looking at the benefits of the banking industry.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wish it hadn't been, you know, well over 20 years ago, maybe closer to 30 years ago, since I had contracts in constitutional law, and haven't, you know, really had an opportunity to research this in any depth. But it does strike me
that we do have certain types of contracts in the state that we consider void as a matter of public policy, and that we can prevent people or say that we're not going to honor or agree to certain contracts just because that they are not good for the health of society and they're against public policy. And with respect to the type of contracts that we are addressing here now, we said last session that these contracts are not allowable anymore because they are against public policy, and so we basically prohibited them. And so really, you know, this is kind of a unique situation because we're retroactively, they weren't prohibited at the time they were entered into, but they are prohibited now. We have a public policy reason for discontinuing these types of contracts because of the type of societal difficulties that they led to. And so this seems to be sort of a hybrid situation. And I don't know if it would be helpful. I don't remember if there was any initial language at the beginning of this that we took out, but I don't know if it would be helpful in terms of addressing that constitutionality issue to have a purpose statement to say that there, you know, that this is a public policy considered to be an emergency, and that these contracts have been found to be contrary to public policy, and so it certainly is not something the legislature ever undertakes lightly. And I hope the business community understands that, you know, the idea of interfering with contracts and the constitutional protection there is taken very seriously by the legislature, and that absent some really grave concerns about impact on society, that certainly isn't something we would normally do.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if Senator Olson wants a reply to that. I guess two things I would say. Number one, I agree with you that these are contracts that you could argue really don't fit our public policy goals under our current understanding of what's okay, but also that we're not trying to nullify these contracts either. So we're just trying to give people a little more time to try to figure out how to get their way out of the hole that they're in. And so, but secondly, in terms of the purpose language, I guess you have to check with Senator Betzold, who's also on this committee. I've tangled with him about purpose language, and I think it would be a good situation to state that, but I'm not sure that some senators really don't like putting that into bills. So I agree with what you're, you know, the intention that you're expressing, though, Senator Olson.
Our next testifier. Yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Financial Services Association, and I'm also the executive director of the Minnesota Mortgage Association. And I'm not going to cover the ground that people have previously covered. I'm going to say some new things. And number one, it's that we get the fact that this is an emergency also. We understand that this foreclosure situation is abysmal. The problem is, and the reason why we're here to object to this bill, as compared to the 7 or 8 other foreclosure bills that are making their way through the legislature, where we support all of those, the reason why we object to this one is because we think we're pouring gasoline on the fire. And here's why. We, in the Commerce Committee, were asked whether or not this was going to lessen the availability of credit in Minnesota or increase the costs. So we decided that we would ask the people that make the credit available. Now, as Associate Professor Cox had mentioned or opined that this may or may not do that, we have a letter that we received today, and honestly, in my 30 years of experience here at the Capitol, we have never received this letter, nor has any other state received this letter in the entire history of the securitization industry. This is the first letter issued to this effect. So if you would be so kind as to pull out that letter, it is a very important document for us, and the reason why we are worried is explained in that letter. This is the letter dated March 14th. I'll just draw your attention to the last phrase of the first paragraph. This legislation would, if enacted, impose substantial costs and threaten the future availability of mortgage credit to all Minnesotans. Okay. Why would we believe these people? Because these are the folks at the American Securitization Forum and SIFMA who actually buy Minnesota loans. They actually take care of the securitizations. And Senator Scheid asked a question a little bit ago. Isn't the entire market facing difficulty? And the answer to that is yes. And when we read the papers tomorrow morning, we'll see that Bear Stearns basically went in the ditch today. And they have a enormous, they're the eighth largest investment bank. This is horrible news for our nation's economy. They will face a diluted stock price, no question about it. The question is whether they'll be able to survive. So, yes, these securities are in trouble. Now the issue becomes, should we, in our state, in Minnesota, define and isolate our state as an island in this credit crisis? And the answer is no, we should not. Because if we do, we will find that there will be less credit available in Minnesota. As a matter of fact, the securities folks say there might be no credit available for those that need it most. Who are those that need it most? They are the people who have adjustable rate mortgages that are resetting. Right now, about $150,000 per month. Divide that for a Minnesota number, it's somewhere $3,000 plus. So those loans that are resetting that we face in this tidal wave, we don't know where we will get the money to make those loans. And it's really quite that simple. One of my colleagues today told me this really isn't a deferral bill, it's a mortgage shutdown bill. Now, I don't usually talk in such absolute terms, but I am gravely worried based on the fact this is the first time this institution has issued this letter, and we're the first state to receive it. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Martin, isn't it, though, that it's not an issue that people aren't going to be able to refinance? I mean, people already are not able to refinance right now. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that some of these individuals who are in these circumstances, the reason why they're asking for the deferment is that virtually they have no other avenues to refinance. And short of, I think that the issue is to give them a little bit of breathing space, because the crisis here is that these people can't refinance, period. It's not as if this bill is going to make it impossible for people to refinance. It's impossible for people to refinance right now. Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right that at certain levels of the credit gradations, it is extraordinarily difficult and in some cases impossible to find that refinancing right now. What we fear will happen is that the credit gradations at which we can refinance people right now will all of a sudden increase. So, for example, FHA and others are changing their standards and their qualification credits every day, and they are headed north. And so the credit squeeze is absolutely there. You're absolutely right. And now what's going to happen is that that credit squeeze will migrate north in the credit gradation levels. Everybody knows that student loans and auto loans and all other kinds of credit are being restricted. And this is really going to get a death grip around Minnesota's neck as far as credit availability is concerned.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Martin, the way you characterize the Bear Stearns deal, it's somehow or another it's due to the economy, but and the people I talk to and the reading that I do tells me otherwise, that it's just poor business practices. And I know that my data isn't laid out here today, but I venture to say that I could go on to the Internet and get ample data to indicate and support just what I'm telling you, that we as a state are not responsible for these problems that exist. but we've got to figure out some way to do something with those. And I think making bad loans and to handle the practice that we're talking about with subprime lending, just it's unconscionable. And I think that you should be here helping us figure out a way to deal with that.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, you know, you're absolutely right. We should be helping rather than hurting. And I was interested in your commentary relating to what happened during the Great Depression. And President Roosevelt established a federal organization that was disbanded in 1951 to deal with the fact that I think the figure is 65% of the of then what we took as mortgages were in severe jeopardy. And that was the right thing to do. It was a federal solution. And I'm sorry, Senator Foley, I can't remember exactly the name of that entity. I know that it was disbanded in the early 50s because it was a success story. It did the job. And if we don't have a federal solution, if we stand alone as a state, we will draw attention to ourselves and be passed over when the securitizers make money available. And so that's our concern. We actually think that we're trying to help by pointing out these issues on this bill. The other foreclosure legislation that's going through, we've supported. Absolutely. And we supported the predatory lending legislation last year. And I would just like to make one other comment. Senator Olson's question about the applicability of this bill and the contracts, and actually, is the word novating a contract? I can't remember from my contract law either, Senator. But I remember that the last year's bill defined subprime, but it also indicated what kinds of loans were predatory. Not all subprime loans are predatory. This bill, however, includes all of the subprime loans, not just predatory.
Thank you, gentlemen, and Ms. Larson.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson, will you come back up to the table? And then I believe that there's an amendment with the technical suggestions by Mr. Dunleavy that we have.
Madam Chair, does it Senator incorporate Anderson? All the pieces that, well, we'll take a look at it. And I know there's our staff is working very hard to keep up with all of these ideas we have.
There's an A7 amendment.
Execution by the sheriff. That's a bad start.
I need a copy, please.
This is the appropriate Jared? Committee for the death penalty, isn't it?
Yeah, I was thinking it was. Okay. Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
see the language. This is one thing that was mentioned by Mr. Dunleavy that was discussed by him and Professor Cox before the hearing that further clarifies his concern about protecting marketability of title after a foreclosure. And maybe, Mr. Professor, it doesn't deal with the other two issues, which I think we have resolved as well, but those are still being
Professor Cox.
Drafted. Just very quickly, this is something that Mr. Dunleavy and I worked on to make it clear that after the foreclosure sale, there aren't any, that is prima facie evidence of the compliance with the Act. Therefore, there's a record of, there's something in the recording system providing a record of assurance that the title is clean, together with the other language which protected BFPs that should take care of any questions about marketability of title.
Any questions, Senator Anderson, on the A7 amendment? Senator Parasol?
I don't know if Senator Anderson or counsel might want to. Is this only applicable under reckless or bad faith, and it has no other effect?
Pardon me, Madam Chair, I didn't quite hear the question.
Is this is the content of this amendment only applicable to homeowners who had monetary relief under this reckless or bad faith violation?
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
the purpose of this is that if a foreclosure goes ahead, that we don't want a homeowner to say, we don't want something clouding the title of that home. We want it to be able to be resold to somebody else and not have a homeowner say, well, they didn't send me proper notice about my deferral right, therefore, I'm going to blow up the whole sale of the home. So this is just saying that if you cannot, as a homeowner, you can't go back after the foreclosure actually takes place and do anything that would affect the title to that property, regardless of what happened under the mortgage deferral. So, once there's a sheriff's sale, then the only remedy that a homeowner would have, if they argue that their lender didn't give them the proper notification or they didn't allow them to defer their mortgage under this bill, they could go after that lender, but they couldn't affect the marketability of that home that's sitting on the market.
Thank you.
On the A7 amendment, Senator Olson moves the A7 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
It's worked out on the other things.
There's a...
Well, let's propose that. Madam Chair, Professor Cox was trying to fix the problem with the notice, and I believe Professor Cox proposed that we just say this won't apply until for any foreclosure sales that are pending, so that it wouldn't apply until any new sales come along. And I guess, is that right? Did I state that correctly?
Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, what I'd propose with Mr. Dunleavy to take care of the concern about foreclosing attorneys having a sufficient time to send out the notices was that we just make the notice perspective. The homeowner, immediately upon effective date of the act, has the right to present an affidavit of deferment, but there's no but the only notice requirement for the foreclosing attorney and therefore their lender is prospective. We just get rid of the requirement of notice to people with pending foreclosure sales.
So in the bill, Professor Cox, we would eliminate starting at line 6.2, notwithstanding, all the way down to line 6.8. Is that what you're suggesting?
Madam Chair, to be precise, I was suggesting delete the words "the terms" on line 6.1, then delete line 6.2 through line 6.8. And then add on line 6.1 after subdivision 2, period, the following, quote, no notice is required for borrowers with a foreclosure sale scheduled on the first day of the deferment period.
Please repeat that.
So it would delete the term. Thank you. No notice is required for borrowers with a foreclosure sale scheduled on the first day of the deferment period. That's a little unclear. It should be, have I read it? For borrowers with a foreclosure sale scheduled during the deferment period. That won't work. You know what? Mr. Dunleavy didn't want it more than this. What I would propose, if it's okay, Senator Anderson, is that we know what the concern is, that it's imposing too many burdens, and that we try to work something out for amendment on the floor. It's kind of hard to draft on the fly here. If you like, I can work on this while you're talking.
Well, Madam Chair, you have a couple more bills in your committee. Is that right? Could we come back with the final language today too? I mean, whatever, it's up to you. We also have Senator Olson's concern about making sure the borrower knows that they still owe the whole amount of the loan. And that, are you working on that?
Oh. Why don't we take care of the rest of members' concerns and see if we can get that language in? Senator Anderson, I am giving a lot of time to this bill. And we worked for a really long time on Senator Ortman's bill yesterday and last night. And when it was getting to the point where we were going to have to do a lot of writing in the committee,
I asked her to lay it over because she has a good bill, and I really like her bill. And if there was a way for us to make the mechanics work, I would have liked that bill to go on the floor too. So to the extent that we can very quickly resolve some of these issues, we could try to move this bill, but if it's going to take more time,
all right, we'll do
we
it.
May
we'll
have to revisit, all right?
We'll get
so,
it done.
So, Professor Cox, why don't you take care of that piece of it?
Okay.
Is there another amendment?
Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid?
I have one, and I know that Senator Anderson or Professor Cox haven't, I'm sure they haven't seen it, the A8, but it has to do with kind of redefining for purposes here two of the mortgages that are defined as subprime. It doesn't deal with the arm, and that would just stay with current law definition. But right now, for a first mortgage on the property in current law, that rate to qualify for subprime would be defined as one that's 3 points more than the yield on the U.S. Treasury securities. Okay? At whatever time the loan was taken out. This raises that to 4, and then on a second mortgage, subsequent lien on the property, current law defines it as subprime if it's more than 5% or 5 percentage points. This would be more than 6 in my language that I'm suggesting. This then narrows the target a little more. And I think that's what we want to do. I had something much greater than this to begin with, but I think that was the federal language. And the federal language is, I think, like 8 and 10 or something. But I don't want to go that far. But this does further define or further narrow the range of the loans that we're talking about.
So, Senator Scheid, in regular people language, what does that mean? What does this mean? Yes.
What does this mean? The bill depends on what we did last year to define subprime loan, which is in 5802 from last year. And for the first mortgage, a subprime loan means a loan for which the annualized percentage rate is greater than 3 percentage points above the yield on U.S. Treasury securities. So if you look at the chart.
I have one of those charts. I don't have a chart. Don, get us the chart.
See where. For a loan, let's say, taken out in January of 2004, that would be a loan that would be 7.87, well, on the 20-year. We'd have to look at the 20-year on this one. Okay. So, I'm not sure.
Do we need to
maybe a couple tenths one way or the other, I think. Maybe a little less. Then for the second mortgage, if you will, the subordinate subsequent mortgage, that says where the APR is greater than 5 percentage points above the yield on U.S. Treasury securities. So that would be a second mortgage that would be, you know, at, let's say, 10 or so percent above that. This raises the
change it to the word pending.
And I think we get, I think that's really, truly getting into where people have gotten in big trouble. So I'm just trying to narrow the field of which loans we're addressing here, which borrowers we're trying to help.
Senator Olson?
So, Madam Chair, so just as an example, I think if we were looking at this chart where they were saying that we would be including some loans that were made in the 6 and 7% range, instead we'd be saying that they would be in the 7 and 8% range. So we would just be those loans that were closer to a more of a prime rate loan would be eliminated. We'd be setting the bar just slightly higher.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair,
I'm wondering whether this needs to specify exceeding the yield on 20-year U.S. Treasury securities and specifying of the date of the purchase. I mean, somebody could look at this and say, oh, and today's rate is 4.55, so that would be the rate that it is, rather than going back and looking at the date of the mortgage.
Can I say something?
Yes. Senator Scheid?
Well, I think Senator Higgins raises a good point. And Ms. Pontius and I were trying to figure out what language we needed to reference from the
Professor Cox?
From current 5802.
Professor Cox?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Scheid. There's so many things get said in these that sometimes, you know, we've let things go. I want to address the underlying argument here that this 6.75 gets thrown around. This is really a red herring. The definition of sub, and they get that by adding 2 points to the 20-year rate plus adjustment a little. The definition of subprime in our law last year, which is the standard definition of subprime for the most part, comparable to the definition in federal law used by HUD to determine the list of subprime lenders, and that is written into most of the federal legislation that's being considered, is this trigger. The 2 points actually only applies with something we wrote in last year and is now starting to be adopted in some of the proposed federal legislation. It only applies to loans that can go up but not down an interest rate that are adjustable. And that was an attempt to pick up these teaser rate 228 loans, where the initial rate on the loan, which was the determining factor for whether it was subprime, was actually a rate under the real rate of the loan. So at the end of 2 years, it was going to go up, even if market rates stayed the same. So that's what that 2 points was.
And, Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I don't mean to eliminate that, and I think that I do by changing the definition here of subprime. So I want to pick that up from last year on the ARMs, on the adjustable rate that can only go up. And I'm fine with that.
Madam Chair, I could make one more.
Professor Cox?
Go back to the drawing board here.
Sorry.
Senator Olson? Madam Chair, in the meantime, I have this amendment now that had to do with the notice provision draft.
Hang on a second. Senator Scheid, what do you want to do with your A8 amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if Ms. Pontius is able to help me out here.
Senator Scheid, did you move your A8 amendment yet?
I don't think so.
Okay. Then we'll just lay it aside. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A10 amendment, which Ms. Pontius has drafted, which would be added to the end of the notice that would have to be given to the borrower, just to make sure that there isn't a sticker shock at the end of this deferment period and that it's clear that we're not just lowering the rate for a time period and then going back and going on as if, you know, nothing had ever happened, that that money is going to have to be made up at the end of the year to avoid a foreclosure sale. So it isn't just a temporary lessening of the loan. It's actually a window of opportunity to find another loan, sell your house, whatever. But we can't interfere with the contract to the extent that we just forgive this money. So the amendment reads on page 4, line 35, after the period, insert, by the end of the deferment period, you will need to pay the entire amount that has been deferred plus other costs allowed by law in order to avoid a foreclosure sale.
And Senator Olson, what happens if they can't afford to pay the entire amount? Does that get added on to the mortgage?
Madam Chair, that's not contemplated by this bill. We talked about this in Commerce, and actually, no, it's not like Senator Ortman's bill where it would get added on to the end. They would actually have to pay the full amount under what's contemplated by this bill. That's why I wanted it to be so clear that they knew that, so that it didn't come as a surprise.
Well, and for people who can't afford it anyways, potentially, I mean, if the amount is like, what, $5,000, $10,000, who can come up with $5,000,
$10,000? Well, actually, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins, actually.
We have a bill working its way through the legislature that increases the amount of money that folks who are looking at a foreclosure can get as a no-cost deferred loan from the MHFA. Currently, it's capped at $6,250 or something, and we are able to, or we changed it to allow us to be able to do about double that, so around $12,000, because some nice bank gave MHFA a $500,000. But they can go, if they go to the mortgage foreclosure prevention counselors, they can, if the counselor thinks that can help them, that would be money that's available. That money is available for people who, once they pay what is overdue, are able to keep up with the existing payments as they go forward. So that money would be available to them.
And Madam Chair, another thing that was talked about in Commerce is the fact that we were hoping that the federal government may offer some relief here, and that one of these things was the window of opportunity to try to keep people in their homes while we wait and see what the federal government does.
Senator Olson, Office 810 Amendment. Senator Anderson?
Oh, Madam Chair, this is a good amendment. I appreciate it. The 810 Amendment.
Any further discussions on the 810 Amendment? Seeing none of those favors the 810 Amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I think we have, I guess counsel is still working on it, but Mr. Cox figured out the one word that had to be changed on the other piece about the notice by the foreclosing lender.
Mr. Cox? Yes.
I gave it
to them.
Counsel has it.
At page 6, line 1, after subdivision 2, period, insert. No notice is required for borrowers with a foreclosure sale pending on the first day of the deferment period. Shall I repeat that, members? After the period, insert, no notice is required for borrowers with a foreclosure sale pending on the first day of the deferment period. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I would ask if Mr. Dunleavy is available here, if he could tell us whether pending, if that is some kind of a term of art, or if that would be clear to the industry that they would understand what that means with a mortgage foreclosure pending. So in other words, it isn't just, you know, the bank has sent it over to the lawyer, or does it mean there has to be a notice filed in the paper at that point, or is there a clear understanding of what pending would mean?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the term of art would be commenced, and what commenced means is the execution and recording of the notice of pendency for the foreclosure. And I wasn't paying attention enough to listen to that language.
So Madam Chair, I'd suggest it should say commenced instead of pending?
I'd have to see the language. Can I see the language?
I don't have it.
She just read it.
I don't think you want that, Kevin.
It's being typed, but it'll take a few minutes.
If he's going to change it, we'll type it.
I guess we're just waiting for Mr. Dunleavy to take a quick look and perhaps suggest if there's something that would clarify the language.
Yes, Madam Chair. Do you want to read that?
Mr. Dunleavy?
Senator Olson, the language I suggest is no notice is required for a foreclosure commenced on or before the effective date.
Senator Anderson, is that satisfactory?
Madam Chair, that sounds good, and I appreciate your making sure it works for the term of art.
Say that again.
I think that works.
Mr. Dunleavy, would you repeat that one more time, please?
No notice is required for a foreclosure commenced on or before the effective date. So that means anyone commenced after the effective date, there is a notice requirement.
So, Senator Anderson, would you like to move that, an amendment to incorporate that language?
Senator Anderson cannot move that language.
Oh, that's right. She's not a member.
Senator Olson, you can move that language.
Madam Chair, I would be happy now that you've returned to move that language.
Senator Olson moves the language as stated by the witness to be inserted at line 6.1 after subdivision 2, period. Insert that language. Any further discussions? All those in favor,
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel?
Does the rest of the paragraph stay in or is that out?
The rest of the paragraph gets deleted down to line 6.8, yeah. And Senator Olson incorporates that into her amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Anderson, I believe there's only one more.
Well, I'm sorry. Issue here.
Is she working on this amendment?
I think she's working on that amendment.
If she fixes it, is it going to make it better?
No.
I think maybe we should start.
I mean, basically, if you fix it, you have no idea how many people are going on. 3 points is a very aggressive definition of subprime. It loses if you want the industry to say it's subprime. You're already losing.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, the A8, and I think members have a copy of it. We would at the end of on 1.15 after 226, am I correct, Ms. Pontius? You would insert, in the case of an adjustable rate loan, the definition in section 5802 subdivision 7 applies.
Oh,
so we're picking up the adjustable rate language from last year's bill, and we're bumping up the interest rate, if you will, on the other two kinds of mortgages, the first mortgage, a fixed rate, and the second one would be a second mortgage.
Senator Scheid, it should be 27.
I wrote it down wrong.
She wrote it. Ms. Pontius miswrote that.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is subdivision 27. I'm sorry.
So, Senator Scheid, could you repeat that?
I just want to make sure that it comes at the end of line 1.15. Yeah. In the case of an adjustable rate loan, comma, the definition in section 58.02, comma, subdivision 27 applies, period.
Senator Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, I prefer the committee not adopt this amendment. I'm concerned about not really knowing how many foreclosures would go forward with this amendment. I don't know. I really don't know. Do you want to say something about it?
Let's do this.
Mr. Cox maybe can address it.
Senator Anderson, let's do this. Senator Scheid offers the A8 amendment. And then Senator Scheid offers the language to amend the A8 amendment. So let's vote on the amendment to the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, if she wants to incorporate it.
Senator Scheid, would you like to incorporate
yes,
that into your A8 amendment?
Yes.
Okay, so now Senator Scheid has offered the A8 amendment incorporating in the new language. We have the A amendment before us. Senator Anderson has spoken on it.
Madam Chair, could I ask Mr.
Professor Cox
just to say a word about it, please?
Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, I'd like to talk about the overall amendment.
Yes, you are now on the overall amendment. We've incorporated the new language into the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson and Senator Scheid, the definition of subprime in the HUD definition, which has been incorporated here, was incorporated last year and is in here, is a very conservative definition of subprime. You lose a lot of what would be colloquially called subprime loans by going 3 points over. Just to give you an example of how far over we are, during the period we're talking about, when the interest rates were in the fours. The 20-year was in the four, and the adjusted 30-year stayed in the four. We're talking about a loan 3 points over. We're talking about almost a 75% premium as the base, as the floor. So somebody with a 65% premium under the existing law, under the existing legislation for the amendment, who's paying 65% more than the prime rate, interest rate, would not be subprime. If you go to four, you're talking about, at that period particularly, 100% premium. I don't know how many people you're dropping off. It is clearly a large chunk. And you're taking an already conservative definition of subprime, and you're making it really quite stringent. So you're losing the protection for thousands and thousands of borrowers.
Madam Chair, I don't know if
Senator
Mr.
Scheid
Cantor wanted to speak to
Mr.
this.
Mr. Cantor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to talk a little bit about the definition of subprime within federal law. I'm not sure that there's any specific federal law that currently exists that uses the word subprime. There are a number of laws that talk about different classes of loans. It is true that within the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, there is a separate category of loans that requires special reporting by lenders, and that category of loans does have the rate that is specified in 5802 as a subprime loan. But there's also another category in the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act for reporting, which is based on the Homeowner Equity and Protection Act passed in 1995. And that is incorporated in Truth in Lending, and that is defined specifically as a high-cost mortgage, which gets us closer to the definition of subprime without actually using the word subprime. And under HOPA and under Truth in Lending as currently enacted, a high-cost mortgage is 8% above the Treasury Index that we're talking about for first liens and 10 points above the Treasury Index for subordinate liens. So I do want to clarify that when we talk about what's an accepted definition of subprime loan through federal law, and I would like the committee to know that there are other terms that could be used that would also that under federal law is considered a high-cost mortgage, but I don't think we have a standard definition of subprime loan, as Mr. Cox asserts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I know you started talking about this before I got into the room, but what's the matter with our definition that we did last year that we struggled so mightily to get to?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, my concern was we were pulling in too many things. I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Senator Scheid has withdrawn the AA amendment.
Thank you for indulging me. And, Madam Chair, if I may thank Ms. Pontius for trying to help me. Thank you.
Ms. Pontius is very much looking forward to 6 o'clock tonight.
As are we all.
We have Senate File 3396 as amended before us.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 3396 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Is it me now? Senator Olson.
Do we have all the amendments?
I think so.
Yes, we have all the amendments. Senator Olson, why don't you go over there to the table, and we'll look at Senate File 3235. And then I think we should look at the Senator Betzel's 3664. And has that amendment, Ms. Pontius, has that been drafted into an amendment?
We'll get it to you.
I understand we weren't going to do the Hennepin County Medical Center. Not the bill yet from this morning.
We're not going to do the bill. Oh, you don't want to do that? You talked to Don? All right. Good. All right, Senator Olson, all we have is your bill. Senator Betzel.
Okay,
has asked, is going to withdraw Senate File 3664. Senator Olson, we're back to your data practices and technical changes bill. I believe there are a number of amendments. Members, we have been notified by the other body that they are putting together an omnibus data practices bill, even though earlier today I had announced that we're not going to, we weren't thinking about one, but we figure once we've been notified, we ought to just play. So, we are going to put attempt to put together an omnibus data practice bill just so that Senator Olson, as she moves forward, if to the extent that we need to, we can have some parity in language. So there's the A6 amendment. Ms. Pontius? The A6 amendment.
Madam Chair, members, I know that was one of the bills you passed this morning, but I can't remember the file
yes,
number.
Yes, I have A6 passed written on it already.
I made it.
So it went on this morning, didn't it? Do we have to
the A6 amendment is Senate file.
3664.
It's Senator Olson's bill.
Is that, Madam Chair, was that the state auditor's bill? I haven't seen the amendment yet.
Maybe that's the wrong bill.
Right here. Is this the agenda? No.
It's the Betzel bill, 3664.
Madam Chair, I'll need to have a copy of the amendment.
Senator Olson, the A6 amendment is Senate File 3716. And Senate File 3716 was passed by the committee and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the amendment, the A6 amendment, to be
included in Senate File
3235.
Any discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
A6 amendment. That was the Rebecca Otto thing.
What's the
next one? Okay.
Madam Chair, next I have the A7 amendment, which was the amendment that has to do with the Social Security numbers.
I believe that's Senate File 2645.
Okay. So I'd like to move the A7 amendment to be added to or attached to Senate File 3235.
On the A7 amendment, as moved by Senator Olson, any discussions?
Is that, Madam Chair, is that the one that dealt with the federal problem?
The amendment. This is the Social Security
number.
It was the
Social
number.
Security number in the
Madam
court
Chair,
files
yeah.
that I presented
yeah.
this morning on behalf of Senator Moore.
An alternate paper is going to be documentary submitted.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, on the court paper. It's a petition, right?
With the amendment on it, yes.
Yes.
All right. And the A7 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, next I have the A8 amendment, which was the Business Screening Services Data Practices. I'm not sure which bill number this was.
This is Senate File 914.
Senate File 914.
Yeah.
So I would move that the A8 amendment be amended to Senate File 3235.
Senator Olson has moved the A8 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
I think you are.
Is that it?
I think so.
Is that it? Senator Olson, you've done quite a bit of work. I believe that's all the amendment that's at the table.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Betzel?
I don't know if my bill might be a candidate to be rolled in as well, too, so maybe you should consider setting Senator Olson's bill aside. We'll hear my bill, and if we decide we like it,
That's
maybe
true.
We can add that in there, too.
That's true. So, Senator Olson, we'll lay you on the side until we finish with this one. We might want to dual track this one, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, those are the perks of being the vice chair of a committee. To the third-party vendor who tried all this time to come and present information, I want to personally thank you. Mr. Greg Moan.
Madam Chair, on Senate File 2754, the committee will remember that this morning you had some questions about just who are these third-party contractors who are going to be receiving criminal history record information on behalf of the school districts, and I'm told that we have some third-party contractors here who can clarify the information. Is that what we have?
Is it Mr. Moan?
Madam Chair, yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record, and then if you have any testimony you want to give us, that's fine. Otherwise, we have questions we'd like to ask you.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Gregory Moan, M-O-H-N. I am CEO of Orange Tree Employment Screening. We are a consumer reporting agency. We currently do background checks and drug testing. One of our areas of focus is with school districts, and we have over 90 school districts that are currently customers of Orange Tree Employment Screening.
Mr. Moan, we're interested in knowing sort of the process. So how do you go about getting the information to do the background checks? And then once you're done with the background check, what do you do with the information that you've procured?
Madam Chair, I won't go into great detail unless you have more questions, but we start the process once we received a release signed by the applicant of one of our customers that allows us to gather this information on their behalf. And then we go based off of the information that our customer has required. For an example, a county criminal check, then we send a court researcher to that county. Let's say it's Hennepin County, and we search to see if they've had any convictions within the past 7 years, which is a standard under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If there is, then we would bring that information, and that information would go on a report that would then get sent to our customer.
And Ms. Moan, that would be all convictions?
That would be, Madam Chair, that would be all convictions within the last 7 years.
And how do you present that information, Mr. Moan? Tabulated form?
The information, Madam Chair, the information is presented in a PDF report that is in a secure website that is username and password protected for our customers only. And then they go online and they can open up the report.
Then, Ms. Moan, do you retain any of that information in your own database, or do you just send it off and that's it?
Madam Chair, we retain a copy of the report in a secure database for as long as the customer asks us to retain that.
And once that retention period is over, Mr. Moan, what do you do with the information?
We don't do anything with it. If they say that they want us to hold it for, let's say, for example, a 3-year period, then after 3 years we would destroy that information. It is our policy of Orange Tree Employment Screening, and I'm going to talk on behalf of my company, that the information we've gathered for our customer is the customer owns that information. We do not own that information, nor do we ever resell that information to any other entities. So if another school district had the exact same candidate, which does happen, we would go out to the county courthouse and redo that check on an individual basis for each customer.
Mr. Moan, do you ever cross-check the same information? For example, if you did that check on somebody 10 years ago, or maybe it's like 3 years ago and now you're doing them today and you find a different set of information, do you cross-check or update, or it doesn't matter once one file is finished, that stays intact, and then the second file is independent on its own?
The only thing that we would check for is to see if there is a duplicate for the same customer. And the reason that is because sometimes there's different departments as when you get into bigger companies, and the companies want to know whether they've already submitted a background check on this individual, and they want to be notified of that. So we would check to see if there would be a duplicate of that applicant, and then notify our customers if there have been. But that's the only time we would check that.
Any other questions for the witness from members of the committee? Senator Foley.
Madam Chair. Mr. Moen, is it?
Yes.
In regard to data, are you in any way licensed or regulated in any way to access this data and then distribute it?
Mr. Moen?
Madam Chair, and Senator Foley, we are regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Uh-huh. They do not have a license or certification. So under that scenario, there's not a license. We are an incorporated company.
Is that a
company.
Private organization?
I'm sure.
Mr. Mong?
Senator Foley, we are a private sub-S corporation.
And the, Madam Chair, and the other
Senator
person
Foley.
That you get it from, is not licensed either.
Simone?
Senator Foley, could you please clarify
well,
that for
I'm
me?
I'm curious to know whether there's regulation in the industry that you're in and who that might be, or is it strictly a private business, or what? How would you characterize that?
Well, there is the regulation is there's federal regulation, which is the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act governs our industry as a consumer reporting agency. Now, along with that, there are state laws, and each state has different laws as far as the types of information that can be gathered and how you can use that information for employment purposes. And so we also have to follow state laws. So on top of understanding the Fair Credit Reporting Act from a federal level, we also have to be updated on state laws. We have an association called the National Association of Professional Background Screeners, and that association has hired a law firm, Seaforth Shaw, out of Chicago, and they compile and keep updated all state laws that have to do with the Fair Credit Reporting Act and how to report that information. That's how we stay up to date on any state laws that change and how we use the information, what is reportable, and it changes from state to state. There's certain things in California we can't report where we can report in Texas. So we have to stay up on state law and federal law on how what information we can gather and how we can report it. There is a need for more regulation in our industry as far as the storage and the privacy of this data, and we are in the process with the National Association of Professional Background Screening Association of putting together a accreditation program, and it's a very, very difficult accreditation to get through. It's just being launched this year, and it's for the reason so that we don't have companies in our industry that are selling outdated and incomplete information and calling it a background check.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Betzel.
Senator, let me also point out, on page 2, line 14 of the A2 Amendment, we reference section 1305, subdivision 11, and that's a provision that was added to the Data Practices Act a few years ago because we recognize that there are situations when data is going to be outsourced, and we wanted to make sure that if it was going into the hands of some private entity, that they were going to have to follow the same principles and guidelines and actually sign a contract saying that they would safeguard the information just as though a government agency had the information. So just because a private entity has it, they have to follow the very same principles. Although the Data Practices Act normally applies to government entities, that's what hooks the private entities into it.
Very good. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, when you're dealing with a private entity like this, as part of their standards, is there any requirement that they be bonded because I know, you know, if there's a penalty, or if you're dealing with a government agency, then the government stands behind it. But if you're dealing with a private entity that might suddenly just disappear, or, you know, have to go through a lot of difficulty if there is a violation and you're looking for some type of recourse, I know that's... it just kind of makes me wonder whether this wouldn't be a situation where someone should be bonded.
Mr. Kite, Ms. Doslin.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'm Valerie Doslin with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And I think I actually would defer to Mr. Moen on the question regarding the bonding. But just to clarify, if a school district enters into to an arrangement with a third-party vendor, they have to have a contract and they have to receive approval from the BCA in order to enter into this relationship. And in the language, the contract must specify the purposes for which the background check is used, and they have to incorporate into the contract references of a management control outsourcing standard. And I think the BCA can talk a little bit about that, but my understanding is this outsourcing standard is going to include information in regards to specifically authorizing access to the criminal history record, limiting the use of the information for purposes of which that information is provided, prohibit the retention and or dissemination of the information except as authorized in the contract, ensure the confidentiality of the information, and also require the school district provide for audits and sanctions in relationship to the terms of the contract. And I'm not sure if Mr. Moen can answer the question in regard to the bonds.
Mr. Moen, is there currently a requirement for you to bond?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, no, there currently is not.
Okay. Any other discussions?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if we adopted the A2 amendment this morning.
I believe we did adopt the A2 amendment, which is your delete all amendment.
Madam Chair, if there's no other, and I don't know if anybody else is here to be heard on this one, we have an unusual situation here. Because I'm told that Senate File 2754 has met the first deadline in the House. It passed as a separate bill. And it is a data practices bill, and we have to meet first deadline with Senator Olson's bill. I've learned around here that you want to keep your options open. So what I suggest, Madam Chair, you consider doing is simply not taking the vote now, but laying 2754 over. And I'll make a motion in a moment to incorporate the language in here, and perhaps next week we may want, if we need a vehicle to complete the data practices work after we find out what the House has actually done, you have a vehicle ready to go here. So,
Senator Betzel, I like the way you think. All right, then Senator Betzel, Senator Betzel, we'll lay over Senate File 2754.
And then if you could make sure it goes on the agenda next week,
yes.
So we will send it to the floor after the first deadline and before the second deadline.
Then Senator Olson.
May I testify on the bill,
ma'am? On this bill?
Yes, the one that was just presented.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank Senator Betzel for adopting the A2 amendment. It goes both those, if you can share those. It goes a long way with bringing fair information practices in 123B, which is not just for employment situations, but also for volunteers and other folks within the school districts. But there are two things out there that I think as a policy issue, you have to ask yourselves. One is the third-party contract is the first time that that the BCA is going to be doing that. And what I have brought to you is, and when copies get to you, is sort of like a little form how this will work, and then also what the federal guidelines are, which is allowing this third party, for example, Orange Tree, to be able to get BCA data. Now, one of the things that just to share what's going to happen, it's going to be the third-party check, whatever they get. Some may get just those convictions, but some go for arrest. Some go for civil data. Again, it's limited by the FCRA by 7 years, bankruptcy for 10 years. It all depends. But on the BCA, if you were arrested, a conviction 20 years ago, they would get that from the BCA. So they're going to sort of put it together and then give it to the school district entity. And the little handout that I show you is you can see where there's a third-party contract along with the school district. Now, BCA is sort of like up here in the corner. Now, if you take a look at the National Part 906 Outsourcing of the Non-Criminal Justice Administrative Fund, the CFR, and look on the second page, you'll look on there, and that's already been mentioned, is that this contract between the third party, as an example, Orange Tree, and the school district, they're going to have to contract to do all these security audits, da-da-da-da, and all that stuff that's already been said. But who is going to oversee the school districts to make sure that they're going to comply with those security audits, to make sure that the information that's being supplied is not being used for other purposes? Generally, it's been the Department of Public Safety with criminal justice information has done that when it's within local government or whatever to make sure that the criminal history information is being used appropriately. The policy question for you is, do you trust the school districts when they do this contract with third parties, or whether or not you want the BCA to do some audits and independently of that? That's the policy question. If you feel that the school districts can do all that and enforce to make sure if there's a security violation, which says on the front page of this bill, and that these folks shouldn't have the access to that information, that's up to you. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's the policy question. Do you want the school districts themselves to oversee their own issue, or do you want to be able to allow the BCA somehow, some way, to do this like they do with local governments? Madam Chair and members of the committee, as Senator Higgins earlier this morning talked about, maybe the city of Minneapolis can do it with their Parks and Rec or Park Police or something. I don't remember specifically. But I'm just saying the standard you said here is an item that will come down in the future. And secondly, the third-party checkers, they want to make money too. So they're going to be going out to all the public entities and start saying, hey, this is starting to be happening. Let's get that third-party contract. And the standards is a 21-page thing. The BCA, even at this time, has not yet, to my knowledge, come up with what that contract is going to look like and what the standards are going to be in a written form, at least for the state of Minnesota. There's a person from the BCA in that regards. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, on fair information principles, it's positive, but on the oversight and all that, that's a question that you have to decide as policy.
Senator Betzel, do you have any comment you'd like to make to that?
No.
Okay.
Again, Madam Chair, I request that the bill be laid over and placed on the agenda next week as for vote in a possible vehicle for other data practice issues if they have to come up over the next few days.
Okay. Senator Betzel, at the same time, did you want that language amended to the omnibus?
Let's return to your bill, Madam Chair, and then we will make that appropriate motion.
Okay, Senator.
You can just stay
down. Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Olson can just stay right where she is for the time being. All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I'll move that Senate File 2754 as amended be incorporated in data practice onto this bill.
On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senator Olson, on Senate File 3235.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 3235, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor.
On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Members,
happy deadline.
Happy deadline week. Thank you all very much for your good work. And Senate Council, thank you very much. We are adjourned. Okay.